Did you know that Jesus was fully God? Did you know that he was fully man? He is the only one who can save us from our sin. If you check out the Word of God, you'll find that when he's on the Sea of Galilee, he's tired. He's in the bottom of the boat. He's a man. When he stands up and rebukes the storm and the storm is stilled, it's God. When he sits on the side of the well, he's thirsty. He's a man. He tells the woman of Samaria all about herself. He's God. And you can check it all through the Bible. He's fully man, fully God. And at all times, he's in full possession of his faculties.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. It's the 18th of August 2023. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please. But Google, and it just might be that we'll get Lisa Furness popping in from the People's Republic, because there's a terrific exhibition started yesterday evening here and running for a few weeks. So if she can make it in, she will. So we'll hold everything, whatever we're doing at the time, for her if she can make it. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump. Also, that's not just the media doing that, obviously. It's the crooked judicial system too. Now all of the lies about COVID have been forgotten because we've got a new enemy. It's not a virus, it's Putin, although he's probably a virus too. So anyway, this is what the BBC might sound like if it hadn't been adopted and occupied by the Zionist lobby, helping us navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's good old Fourth Industrial Revolution. Hooray, hooray. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
So we've got the zero carbon madness in the at the beginning. We'll be talking about Monkton Wild Court down in Dorset, where there's a festival of resistance taking place. But we'll also be talking about Imber, which is another land rights story. Imber is in the middle of Salisbury Plain. It's a village which was evacuated in the middle of World War II in 1943, actually. And the villagers supposedly were promised that they could go back after the war. Well, that never happened. But the quid pro quo from the army is that there are several days of the year where it's all open and people can go there. And there's Imber Bus Day tomorrow, which means anybody who's in Warminster or surrounding villages of the west side, northwest side of Salisbury Plain, can catch a big red bus all across the plain, which is, they're great fun anyway, and it's organised all, which I found out a few weeks ago, by the boss of Network Rail. So he's not really interested in rail, he loves buses really. That's how nerdy these people are, and me of course, because I'll be there too. And the nice thing about it is that the one remaining building that still operates in Imber, right out in the middle of nowhere in Salisbury Plain, as these artillery shells zoom over the top of it, is Imber Church, called St Giles. And tomorrow it will be converted over to be a cafe for the day, so it's great fun, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. We'll also be, after the break, looking at the Nazi roots of the Brussels EU. Now, we had Jungle Bus Millie on last week, who's an anti-fracking campaigner, and she's was over at the Leicester Festival, you may remember, a Dutch woman who decided that actually Holland was far too snobby and annoying and controlling, where you have to have a licence to have a chimney in your house and things like that. You're not allowed to go and forage mushrooms or blackberries without paying some sort of fee to the government for doing it, which I didn't realise Holland was really like that. That's what she says anyway. And she's decided she loves the Brits and Britain, so she's over here permanently now doing her stuff. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. This show cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. But it's not been cancelled here yet. Still going strong. Martin, I think we'd probably start actually by looking at Starmer, because we picked up last week, didn't we, with the week before it may have been, with the Not the Andrew Marr Show, that there are a lot of people who are Labour activists that are starting to form these various little groups which are more Corbynite than Starmerite. In fact, this week, seen the launch of the summit called the Stop Starmer campaign, which is being run by people who, well, some of them anyway, most of the activists that Keir Starmer has booted out of the Labour Party. So, you know, this could be the same sort of civil war that was going on with Brexit in the Tory party, going on in the Labour Party, because Starmer is a neoliberal, and actually there's still quite a lot of the whole Corbynista sentiment left there.
Well, I'm still in the Labour Party, and I would place myself on the Corbynista wing of it, but I don't think there's going to be the situation is not as it's not as straightforward as you think, because of course a lot of people have left the Labour Party, so lots of people just resigned, walked away, refused to pay their subs. I haven't done that, but it makes a huge, obviously from Starmer's point of view, he's quite happy for these people to just go away. Then you've got people who've been booted out, but they, of course, then they're not in the party anymore, so they don't have any influence within it. And, of course, they are trying to set up alternative political parties. And, of course, you know, we had Chris Williamson on last week, and he set up a party with Galloway. And, of course, they're calling for PR. Which, of course, is what Corbyn could have called for in the first place, but he didn't.
You actually buttonholed him, didn't you, and said, come on, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is that the conventional left that Corbyn represents do not see constitutional change as the central focus of their activity.
Well, there's a good reason for that. That's because Corbyn could quite possibly have won in 2017 without it, if he hadn't been undermined by the Starmerites and the Mandelsonians.
Yes, but they were always going to undermine you. And you could have outflanked them by saying to Green, Liberal Democrat and Nationalist voters, vote for us this one time and we'll change the system for you. And he could have just done it. They did it in New Zealand in the 1980s, even though they had a Labour government. But he didn't do it, and it's too late now. And, of course, Starmer has ruled out any change in the
Is it really a good idea?
It works for him as it stands.
Is it really a good idea to have lots of little parties? I mean, that's what happened in 1930s Germany, isn't it? Loads and loads of little parties, and it was all really very confusing.
Well, look, all of the countries in Europe, apart from us, have a proportional system of one kind or another. And it works in what you get in Spain, for example. We just had a general election in Spain. The Spanish Socialist Workers' Party came second. The Conservatives came first, but they didn't have enough votes to form a government. The far-right vote went down. There's a left party called SAMAR, which is led by Yolanda Diaz, who was a former communist, and they took a substantial chunk of seats. So in the setup in Spain, there's a left-wing party to the left of the Socialist Party, and they have seats. And they are able, therefore...
Well, I know, but, I mean, actually, whoever you vote for, anywhere in Europe, the establishment and the banksters are still really in charge, aren't they? They've got these technocratic leaders that they're selecting.
That is true as well. Of course it is. Just having a proportional system doesn't mean that you can control the banking system or NATO or the deep state. Of course you can't. But without a proportional system, we are forced to vote for Starmer to keep Sunak out. That's the nature of the game, and it's designed that way, just as it is in the United States. And it gives the deep state an absolute veto, which is why, of course, the Irish broke out of the British Empire in the 1920s and put a proportional system in place.
Well, that was also, Martin, that was also to do
place in Northern
it was
Ireland
also
well.
To do with land, wasn't it, and to do with the oppressive landowners.
It's partly to do with land, but it's also to do with the fact that we can't get a say here. We are excluded from.
Well, the interesting thing about that was that the Irish MPs at the time did hold the balance of power, rather like the DUP. Only thing is, they did a lot more with it to liberate Ireland in order to basically transfer the land from the absentee landowners over to the occupiers of the land, who had been very poor peasants. Suddenly, overnight, their direction of their lives changed as they owned their own land. You know, they managed to get these cheap government loans to buy and build. They called it, so they could buy the land and build a new house, and their fortunes changed overnight because of an enlightened bunch of Irish MPs who knew that by holding the balance of power they could hold Westminster to account, and they did that back in the late 1800s, didn't they?
They did, yes, and of course they had a similar impact on the Crofts in Scotland. we are doomed to put up with the bullying tactics of Starmer because the electoral system rewards those bullying tactics.
Yeah.
He is trying to win over former Conservative voters in swing seats, and to do that, he's quite happy to go and spit in the faces of his own left wing, and he turns around...
Well, the thing is, I mean, didn't Jeremy Corbyn...
Don't have to worry about me.
Jeremy Corbyn did that extremely successfully, very, very successfully, but without using the same sort of tactics, didn't he? He did, you know, with the red wall seats.
Well, The whole thing is complicated by Brexit. Obviously, traditional Labour seats which voted for Brexit were then, you know, pushed into the Tory camp as a result of all the shenanigans around that.
Oh, sorry, no, he didn't.
But
he lost. Yeah. Sorry, I just said the opposite of the truth. Can I just correct myself? Because I just was saying that that Corbyn did really well. No, he didn't. It was a complete failure. The Tories did really well by pinching those votes over Brexit. Anyway, look, but rather than argue about this, let's have a listen to David Plank on the Stop the Andrew Marr Show. Not the Andrew Marr Show last week.
I was interested in your story because you actually voted for Starmer to be Labour leader, and now you're agreeing to campaign again to stop him. So can you tell us what your thoughts are on the campaign, just to about why it's important to stop him?
You may recall that I made a contribution a couple of years ago when I described Keir Starmer and his actions as evil. And some people were a bit taken aback by that, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You judge people by their actions. And his actions are evil. And if you just take one or two examples, I mean, his behavior in relation to the Uxbridge by-election is quite extraordinary. That here, a campaign which was undermined by a local candidate not being selected, but by choosing one of the careerist place persons, and where they had already reneged on their Green promises, led to fewer people turning out for Labour than would otherwise have been the case. And yet he turns round and blames Ulez and Sadiq Khan. And because Sadiq Khan is not under his control, he showed the petulance of a dictator.
Mm.
And that petulance has continued in the item that you showed earlier on, in the withdrawal of the promise to roll out Ulez schemes across the country. You can't believe a word that this man says. He is opportunistic. He is entirely self-centered in the pursuit of power. Now, one thing I would like to add is that it's not just Starmer, it's the people around him. You've mentioned on this programme the number of times in which Labour politicians appear in the Daily Telegraph, God help us. You know, in the Murdoch press, how many times? They are part of the problem. And also part of the problem is the people in Labour who, despite this Stalinist behaviour and the cruel treatment of individuals whose mental health has been severely damaged by things that have been done to them. Some of them who've died before they get any kind of hearing in relation to the allegations that have been made against them. When you think of these things that are happening, and yet there are people in the Labour Party keeping their heads down. Mm. And that includes the shadow cabinet, or the shadowy cabinet, as John appropriately calls them, and it includes many other people in the Labour Party. Now, these are the conditions for fascism. And we have a Conservative Party, which is clearly going in the fascist direction. So it is more, this is a collective failure of our political class. And in saying stop Starmer, and I support that phrase very much, I am also saying, and I hope other people will also be saying, we need to be able to say in our society what we think freely, to debate it, to have disagreements, and not to be told that we can't do this and we can't do that. We need a free society, and at the moment we're in a very dangerous place in this country with two parties which don't seem to understand that. So it's for those reasons, together with the promises that Starmer constantly breaks, include the most basic of promises, like to lift children out of poverty. And you know, that decision that he made to say, no, we can't do that because of the economic situation, was a travesty, an absolute travesty. His whole economic policy is extraordinary. It's as if the Bank of England is in charge of the Labour Party. This is a neoliberal, neoconservative approach to economics, which we know from the Jeremy era, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work at any level in our society. It's produced a significant proportion of our population, which is constantly in poverty. Yet this man and these people around him, including Wes Streeting and others, convey this policy as if it was incontrovertible, and it's not. And anybody in the party who disagrees with that policy and dares to say so will be got rid of. Now, these are dangerous times, and that's why I support the Stop Starmer campaign, but I also say stop those in the Labour Party who are part of the same problem. Would it be any different if Wes Streeting was the leader?
So, that was a chap called David Plank on Stop the Andrew Marr Show on their YouTube channel. If you're looking for that clip, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Yeah, this is becoming a bit of a regular thing to check in. I don't know if you'd ever been checking in on it in the past, Martin, but all sorts of interesting people popping up there who seem to be slowly but surely putting together the jigsaw puzzle of a kind of alternative version of the left, which is, you know, like a phoenix rising from the ashes of the Starmer's destruction of the Corbynistas.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agreed with a lot of that. I don't think there's no mileage at all in trying to remove Starmer as the Labour leader at this stage, because there's no mechanism for it. People who've resigned from the Labour Party, I realise why they've done it, but I don't see that it's going to help anything. My strategy has always been, what I do with the Labour Party is when it's going in a direction I think it ought to go in, I'm prepared to get in and do stuff. When it goes in a direction I don't want it to go in, I just work to rule. I don't resign. Wouldn't have any influence at all. I do get to vote in NEC elections, for example. So I voted in the NEC election for Naomi Wimbaugh Midrissi, who set up Jewish Voice for Labour. And she was elected. And then she was suspended by Starmer for being anti-Semitic. Now, this is like a purge.
She is herself Jewish.
Of course she is, yes. But of course, this anti-Semitism thing has been used to attack the left, and of course it's also because of the Israel lobby, as we know. Being a member of the Labour Party is like being a member of the Polish United Workers' Party in 1980s Poland. Now, when Solidarność had 10 million workers out on strike in 1980, 1 million of the membership of Solidarność were simultaneously members of the Polish United Workers' Party. In other words, the middle managers in Polish society, the people that used to run things locally. And that was the way in which gradually the communist system was subverted from within. And I see the Labour Party in this country is very much like that. When Blair came to speak in Bristol years and years and years ago, I was in the audience, and he levelled with the audience at one stage and he said, look, if we mess up our relationship with the Americans, this party will be destroyed. And the whole room was full of Labour Party people, hundreds of people there, and lots of them were nodding like, yes, we can't afford to make the Americans angry, otherwise they'll destroy our party. And the same sort of thing used to be in Poland, where people say we've got to keep the Polish United Workers' Party in power to keep the Russians from coming in. So we've got to work within that system. Now, Starmer is very much the member for NATO. You know, he is going to do exactly what the Americans want. And that's his pitch to the Americans and to the City of London and to former Tory voters in the Red Wall. I'm a Conservative. You can see I am. I'm not going to do anything to upset the boat. We'll see how this thing about not, you see, what was it? He didn't have to say anything about the child, the two-child policy for benefits, but he chose to say we're not going to rescind this. It was an act of, you know, callous brutality by the Tories, because millions of children who are in bigger families are basically going hungry because of it. Ask people like Marcus Rashford about that. And he could easily have just said nothing about it, or he could have said, well, certainly we'll get rid of that. But he went out of his way to say he wasn't going to get rid of it. And I think the SNP will beat him over the head with that baseball bat when it comes to the by-election up in Glasgow, because the people in Scotland don't think like that. And if he thinks he's going to get Labour votes in Scotland by talking like that, he's a fool as well as a gangster.
Well, we're going to be looking at some of those issues even closer here by going to Tony Greenstein's blog. Just looking on there this morning, and I spoke to him earlier today about it. His blog posts are, yeah, I mean, he's been looking at this guy, David Miller, who we've had on this show quite regularly. And he's saying both David Miller, we should be defending David Miller against the Zionists and their apologists on the left. There are many criticisms that can be made of Miller, but anti-Semitism has not one of them. So David Miller's attack on, or Jewish Voice for Labour's attack on David Miller is Jewish exceptionalism. The Socialist Workers' Party's attack is political cowardice. This is what they're saying about Miller, because he's been tweeting a particular tweet which seems to have got, and I do wonder, I look at his tweets and think he's saying this deliberately, because even though this is, it's a bit like when Ken Livingstone talked about the Havara Agreement before the war, which was between the Nazis and the Zionists, and which was meant to lots of German Jews being shipped out to well, it wasn't even Israel at that time, to Palestine. These are facts, but they're inconvenient facts. And what people do is they say, well, what you're really saying is this. You're not actually saying that. You're saying something else, and it's something else they criticise him for. So David Miller's tweet, which was on the 6th of August, it's had, nearly a million views. He says the facts. Number one, Jews are not discriminated against. All right, well, okay, so that's a bit provocative. I think probably some Jews are, but what he's saying is not that they're not in the major categories anymore of people who are discriminated against, i.e. the poor are discriminated against. The Corbynistas might be discriminated against. Muslims might be discriminated against, but Jews aren't really up there. Number two is he's saying they are overrepresented in Europe, North America and Latin America in positions of cultural, economic and political power. And number three, they are therefore in a position to discriminate against actually marginalised groups. So it's an interesting statement he's made, Martin. First of all, do you agree with those three points he's making?
I think broadly I do, and I think he's entitled to make these points. I think it's unfortunate that the Jewish Voice for Labour have decided to distance themselves from him on that basis. But undoubtedly, other Jewish voices like the Greenstein, who we're going to hear in a moment, will not agree with that. I think what David Miller's decided is you might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. You know, there's no.
Well, I wonder if it's not a little bit more sophisticated than that. I mean, he's written the book The Century of Spin. He's a very smart chap, and he does understand sociology extremely well. I think what he's doing is he's making statements which are perfectly reasonable to back up, but if he's allowed to back them up. And so if these statements are taken out of context in a fashion where David Miller is not allowed to explain why he said them, in other words, by a crooked or corrupt mainstream press, for example, then they will be. It will cause a massive storm. And what he's doing, in a way, is he's provoking, isn't he? He's prodding the other side and saying, look, I'm going to say this, and what have you got to say about it? And do you dare to get me on to explain what I mean? And, of course, the answer is no, they don't. Generally, they will never contact him to get his point of view. They just want to have a go at the guy.
That's true. And, of course, he's making a virtue of necessity, because he's an independent critic now. But of course, if he was a member of the Labour Party and trying to get elected to something, he wouldn't be able to do that.
No, so but he might well be for another party. Anyway, let's see what Tony Greenstein had to say. And I'll put a link up to his excellent blog post about it. And, you know, this is, I think, one of the hearts of the modern debate, is whether you're allowed to make legitimate criticisms of the Jewish community, or whether every criticism of the Jewish community is fine to consider every criticism anti-Semitic. Anyway, here's Tony Greenstein speaking to me early today, who is the first Jewish person to be kicked out of the Labour Party. And he does this terrific blog. I love it anyway. Speaking about this controversy, which has been stirred up by David Miller.
David is really not saying a great deal new, though at times the way he says it is not the most brilliant. I've been saying for years, I mean, Jews in this country are not oppressed. Their anti-Semitism is not the same creature that it was 80 years ago. I mean, but for some people anyway, history never changes. If Jews were subject to an anti-Semitism which led to annihilation in Germany, then it must be the same creature forevermore and a day. Times change, even if some people don't.
Okay, so what's David said, and who has responded to it?
Oh, well, Jewish Voice for Labour has responded, all sorts of different groups, the Socialist Workers responded. He said, Jews are not discriminated against. Jews are not oppressed, in essence. Jews are overrepresented now in various areas of public life. Now, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, does it mean you have to, if what it means is that you set numerous clauses, in other words, restrictions on the number of Jews who can go to universities in line with their proportion of a population, then that would clearly be anti-Semitic. But if you're simply commenting on the fact that 0.05% of the population has 3.5%, 3.4% of MPs, that is seven times their ratio in the population. It's not anti-Semitic to simply point the fact out and ask maybe why that is, or why black people are underrepresented, or Muslims, or what have you. Well, some people are simply scared of the truth, regardless. I mean, David Miller in his third. I mean, the problem with David Miller is he's doing these debates on Twitter, and Twitter isn't designed for debate. It's 256 characters, so I have told them, get off Twitter. I mean, write what you want, but you're asking for trouble.
Surely the point, Tony, is that it's not that Jews are overrepresented, it's that Zionists are overrepresented, isn't it?
Well, it's both, in a sense. I mean, Zionists are overrepresented, but Zionists are non-Jewish, of course, as well. I mean, we have a government which is in, you know, has adopted a policy of support for Zionism. So I don't think you can say Zionists are overrepresented. You can say reactionaries are overrepresented, of which the Zionists are a prime figure. But, no, I mean, there's what, 250,000 Jews in this country, approximately 0.5% of the population, of which maybe 70% are Zionists of one flavour and another. So obviously if there are more Jews in certain places than their population numbers warrant, then that will inevitably give a Zionist bias to certain areas of public life, like the BBC, where three successive chairmen have been reactionary conservative Jews. who are Zionists. So, of course, I mean, that just cements the position the BBC already has. But if you say that overrepresentation of Jews is responsible for X, Y, and Z, then I think you get into dangerous territory. But so you have to be clear, really.
Well, David has, so far as I see, David hasn't said that. He hasn't said it's responsible for X, Y, or Z at all. He's just...
No, I mean, people are leaping to conclusions, and for some people, David is a radical figure, difficult to defend, and they're quite happy to use this as the pretext to abandon ship, as it were.
Yeah, what about the Socialist Workers' Party these days? I haven't heard of them for a while, although they're still around. You know, this is an interesting beast, isn't it?
Well, the FWP have always been marked by opportunism. That's their main characteristic. They don't want to be unpopular, and they figure that supporting David at this time is not a popular thing to do. So they've looked for a pretext to jump off the bandwagon. I mean, that's really what it is. I don't have a lot of time for the FWP. It's much tinier now after the rape scandal that enveloped them in 2013. So, yes, it's unfortunate, but people, let's be clear, anti-Semitism, you know, anti-Semitism today in Britain is not what it was 80 years ago when you had a police force which was anti-Semitic. When you had members of the nobility who supported Hitler, when you had the Anglo-Jewish Fellowship and so on, and Anglo-German Fellowship, Robert, and so on. Anti-Semitism has changed, as the Jews have changed. Most Jews used to live in the East End of London. Now they live in, Golders Green, Edgware, Hendon, Redbridge, etc. So as the Jews have changed, so their politics have changed, they've moved to the right. And that is really the basis of this new anti-Semitism. The reality is most Jews today don't know what anti-Semitism is. They have no idea. They've never experienced it. And so you get all this nonsense. And that's how, that is the context in which this fake anti-Semitism smears at people.
Yeah, there are attacks on synagogues still to this day, aren't there?
Well, there actually aren't. I haven't heard of one, have you? Can you name one?
Well, specific dates, no, but I mean, we see it, a blip in
the
news.
It's very, very rare. I have not heard of an attack, a serious attack on a synagogue. I've heard of plenty of attacks on mosques. And you know something? 50 million quid goes now to defend Jewish synagogues, but £1 million goes to the mosques. You know, the attempt, that guy who tried to kill Corbyn couldn't get to the Corbyn, so he headed off to Finsbury Park Mosque and killed one worshipper and injured a number of others when he drove his bus into a crowd. Yeah? I mean, that's a reality. That has never happened at the synagogue, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, Tony, how do people follow your work, then?
Well, you can follow my blog, Tony Greenstein's blog, on blogspot.com. Or you can write to me at tonygreenstein104@gmail.com if you want a copy of my book on the relationship between the Zionists and the Nazis and other anti-Semites, when anti-Semites were anti-Semites.
So what is the topic of the book, and how much does it cost?
Oh, right, sorry. Zionism during the Holocaust. It's actually before and after the Holocaust, but it shows the relationship of the Zionist movement to both the Nazis and their attitude to Jewish refugees and the blocking of their escape routes. You can say it's £10 paperback, £15 hardback, and you can write to me at tonygreenstein104@gmail.com.
Okay, Tony Greenstein, thanks very much for joining.
That's okay, take care.
So, yeah, Tony Greenstein there speaking to me earlier today, the Socialist Workers Party, Martin, according to Tony, he quotes them in his article, Miller targets Jews, Socialist Workers Party complains, Miller targets Jews, not the actual ruling class, and plays on the idea of Jews as ultra-rich and manipulative. All that is missing is the word trope. All Miller has done is to point to the fact that Jews do not suffer discrimination, and I would add that on average British Jews are privileged economically. So the Socialist Workers Party accused David Miller of refusing to see the very real existence of anti-Semitism, which along with Islamophobia has become a standard feature of far-right propaganda. Yet, says Tony, this is nonsense. Islamophobia is the established policy of both major political parties. Anti-Semitism isn't. Anyway, so well, what do you make of this debate?
Well, you can see how distorted all of this has become when people state very, very basic stuff. And you've got a huge refusal to face up to what's really going on with Zionist Israel. And the SWP, and I wouldn't, I mean, the SWP are basically flip-floppers. They're all over the place, and they're very much smaller than they used to be, as Tony pointed out. Jewish Voice for Labour, I'm disappointed that they've taken this kind of line. But I think everybody's just got to get used to the idea that David Miller is going to say what he thinks. And you don't have to agree with it, but you've got to let him say what he thinks, even if you don't agree
with it. Well, Tony also points out the overwhelming majority of fascist propaganda is actually not directed at Jews, but against black and Muslim people.
Well, that's right. We all know the racial hierarchy and how it functions.
Oh, you're not allowed to talk about that, like Diana Abbott did.
It gets me when you've got, you know, apparently we on the left are so woke that we want to cancel people and stop them saying their views. And in actual fact, we put up with people saying anything they like. As far as I'm concerned, they can say whatever they like, and we'll say what we like. Yeah? But don't you know, no crime for mummies when we call them like
it is. The key phrase that David's used is the Jews are overrepresented in Europe, North America and Latin America in positions of cultural, economic and political power. Do you think that's true?
Well, it's a statement of fact, and it is true. It doesn't mean that it's not saying that anything should be done about it. If you don't like your Jewish MP and his pro-Israel politics, then you've got to vote him out, haven't you? You can't vote out people who run things like TV stations and newspapers.
No. Of course not. But I mean, one of the people replying to David Miller's tweet is pointing out, saying, well, actually, it's because many Jews are very smart and or get a very good education. And so it's not a conspiracy. It's because many Jewish people are particularly smart.
Well, that may be so. But the implication of that is that blacks are underrepresented because they're stupid, isn't it? The fact is that they've got very privileged backgrounds. Yeah, they tend to come from the top layers of the society. That's not always been true. In the East End back in the day, you had plenty of poor Jews, and there was lots of discrimination against them precisely because they were poor. They were regarded as sort of, you know, dirty, unlike us and all the rest of it. But of course, as they've assimilated into British society, they generally, the Jewish Chronicle, for example, generally supports the Conservative Party. Now, that's fine. I haven't got a problem with that. But they're not in a position to tell us in the Labour Party what we're going to do. They're not in the Labour Party. They've got no right to say. They can say whatever they like, and we'll say what we like.
Well, I don't know if you know anything about the Socialist Workers' Party's 2013 rape scandal, but the senior party figure was identified only as Comrade Delta, and there was rape accusations against him from people in very close to him within the Socialist Workers Party, and what happened was there was what has been described as a kangaroo court set up to get rid of her. A woman has claimed she was subjected to a series of offensive questions about her sexual past, drinking habits, after bringing an allegation of rape against a senior member of the Socialist Workers Party, and she was branded a slut, apparently, by senior party members. So this is a scandal that no party needs, and the party at the time denied a cover-up. But participants in the dispute committee hearing described the line of questioning as disgusting, and describing the suspension as a travesty. Now, these sorts of things, obviously, you know, it's difficult to know exactly what was going on here, because quite often a fake allegation can be made, and we need, obviously, to see the solid evidence. But the Socialist Workers' Party really is not what it used to be, Martin, is it?
No, a lot of people left it at that stage. I'll make two comments about this. If the woman concerned has been raped, she should be going to the police, not to the party. That doesn't make sense if she's got evidence. The party should have said, we'll take this to the police if they wanted to have it cleared up. But, of course, they don't do things like that, I suppose. The third point is They've been heavily infiltrated by MI5 for years, and this kind of scandal is exactly the kind of thing that they would be behind in order to discredit it, discredit the left in general, and all the rest of it. I don't know. I've got no evidence for that, but we do know that the Special Demonstration Squad had plenty of people inside the SWP.
Whilst chatting about this kind of thing, we were talking really about the, neoliberal policies of Starmer as well there. And a lot of this is to do with that, isn't it, Martin? A lot of these kind of fault lines, anti-Semitism fault lines, aren't just about anti-Semitism. There's actually, and maybe you could just give us your take on the background, the backdrop, because if you look at the whole take of these individuals on one side or other of the divide, either the pro-Starmer camp or else the camp of people who have been falsely accused of anti-Semitism, there is a sort of a difference in their approach, not just to this topic, but to, you know, general things like mixed, whether or not to have a mixed economy, whether or not to go along with neoliberal economics. Am I right?
Yes, you are right. And of course, the other thing that it's a litmus test for is pro or anti-war policy. Yeah, you can pretty much guarantee that if Starmer had been in Parliament in 2003, he would have voted to go to war with Iraq. He would. He's never had to answer a question about it because he wasn't an MP at the time. But you can see exactly, he would definitely have gone along with it. And that is part of the problem.
Yeah, he was busy putting the Jimmy Savile indictments, the evidence against Jimmy Savile while he was still alive, into a shredding machine. Too busy doing that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Steve Keen. I did a Press TV interview earlier this week about Britain's economic woes, but I was really impressed with him again. He was from Kingston University. He now seems to be a bit of a globetrotter. He was over in the Far East for a while. Now he's living in Amsterdam, I think, and just about to move again. He just seems to stay in anywhere for more than a few months. But he's a brilliant economist, I would say. Wrote a book called Debunking Economics. I mean, this is the black art, which, Martin, you studied that at Oxford, didn't you? In your, what was it, the Politics, Sorcery and Economics degree, yeah?
Yeah.
Politics, Sorcery and Economics. Didn't they used to joke that that's what it was?
Well,
Rather than philosophy, sorcery, yeah?
No,
didn't they? I mean, I can't remember being in Oxford and hearing joke.
It is... Lots of people in mainstream politics studied that degree. It was designed in 1918. It was called Modern Greats. So previously, everybody had studied classics at universities like Oxford and Cambridge, and then they ended up in politics. They decided the modern world required something a bit more than translating Julius Caesar. And so politics, philosophy, economics was born as the, you know, this is for the people who are going to run the civil service, be politicians, whatever, which is why I was directed towards it.
Yeah, it's a good degree anyway, certainly.
It's a bit bitty, is the truth of the matter, because you're covering a whole...
Well, I think isn't there a PPE library there?
There is, yeah. I mean, obviously libraries are becoming less and less important to universities.
I suppose so, yeah. People don't read books, kids don't read books, they're reading blog posts and articles.
I mean, going to the library to order stuff from the stack like you or I must have done in the Bodleian.
That's right, yeah.
It just takes ages to get, you know...
Well, it's a day, it takes a day, yeah. I mean, you have to come back the next day. You put your orders in one day, you come back.
It does speed things up if people can look things up on their phone straight away.
Well, yes, I suppose more haste, less speed. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to Steve Keen now with his diagnosis on Britain's economy on the Iranian channel banned in Britain, Press TV.
Hello and welcome to Press TV Spotlight. I'm Mazia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, across the board, from white-collar workers to blue-collar workers, few seem satisfied with their jobs in the United Kingdom. From railway drivers to ambulance driver to lawyers and doctors, just about everyone is demanding better working conditions and an increase in their salaries. Industrial strikes have become common, but few have had desired results. What's going on in the UK and what is next for the British people? Steve, why are we seeing such dissatisfaction across the board with workers in the UK?
I think because the UK has had about 20 to 25 years, so actually longer, 40 years of failed economic and industrial policies with an obsession upon government austerity, and also a belief that manufacturing is not a growth area, so they decided to specialise in services. They're empirically completely wrong. Services have never replaced the manufacturing exports Britain used to make, so it's now running chronic trade deficits while the government tries not to spend money, and that is a recipe for a declining amount of money in the economy and a declining amount of jobs. And finally, the working class and middle class, and that includes doctors in the UK, given its national health scheme, are finally saying they've had enough and they're demanding some sort of compensation for the effective cut in their real incomes over the last 30 or 40 years.
When we look at the situation, we have senior doctors that are going on strike in a few more days. It just seems in general that things are in disarray. I mean, when we look at, especially let's look at physicians, and looking at the situation in the UK, one would think that there would be certain professions that at least the government would look at a little bit closer in trying to, for example, right now, especially after the COVID crisis, the nurses and the doctors gave so much of their time, and actually the government thanked them and said what a great job they have done. But at the end of the day, why isn't anything done for the people?
Largely because of the obsession about running government surpluses, which is, it sounds sensible to most people. Most people think you shouldn't spend more than you earn, but that's applying a household way of thinking to a government, where a government actually creates money, and it creates money by spending more than it gets back in taxation. So if you have an obsession with running a surplus instead, and that's dominated British politics for the last 40 years and certainly the last 15 under the recent bunch of Tories, you're actually destroying money and then telling people the economy to grow faster. And the trouble is, unfortunately, the easiest way for the government to not create money is to pay lousy wages to its workers in nationally owned industries. And of course, in the UK, health is nationally owned. So they find it easier to clap and applaud than pay money, when in fact they should do both. And if they did do both, they'd create more money for the private sector, which might enable economic activity in the UK to get off the floor.
Well, Tony, how much of this goes back to a neoliberal agenda? Because if we look at, again, I go back to Thatcher, or, of course, in the States, it was Reagan at the same time. And we see from then on just a drop in the quality of the lives of workers, and as far as benefits and payments. Your take on that, the role in neoliberalism in this. Does it make a difference, the British government, if Labour is in power or the Conservatives are in power? You've been talking about, and Tony, you've been talking about 40 years. So in 40 years, we've had governments from Labour. We've had them from both parties. Does it make a difference at the end of the day who is actually in power?
It does make a small difference, because the way I describe it is the Tories impose neoliberalism with glee and the Labour Party imposes neoliberalism with an apology, and is therefore likely to be less extreme in how much it cuts back pay and cuts back services and so on. But it still fundamentally wears the same hat. This, of course, is the Labour Party under Keir Starmer, and the Labour Party is created by Tony Blair rather than the Labour Party as it was in the old days, and as Corbyn tried to make it when he was the leader. So if you share the same ideology, you're going to come out with the same sorts of policies, and it's the ideology which is to blame. And it really is an incompatible ideology to Labour thinking overall. The Labour Party has conned itself to believe this ideology. The Tories believe it because it suits them. It still doesn't make the theory any better, but they at least, in a weird way, benefit out of the sort of catastrophes that they've imposed upon the public sector in the UK.
Why does it seem that there's always money, for example, for war? Or we see now how much money London has been giving to Ukraine. I mean, it seems like everything else is prioritized over the British people. Your take on that?
That's true. I mean, the usual mantra, how are we going to pay for it, has never applied to buying weapons or sending troops overseas. That's taken on as a duty, something we must do. Of course, the UK has made appalling choices of where it does that over the last 30 or 40 years. But it seems when national security is mentioned all concepts of budgetary responsibility, so-called, go out the window. In fact, the best security is a healthy society, and that's what's being undermined by all these policies. So, again, it's ideology ruling over logic.
The big corporations are ruling. So what would the British people have to do to actually get control of their country again? I mean, it's the same situation that so many of these Western nations are facing today, that the power is actually in the hands of a few, and the majority of people do not support a lot of the policies that these governments are doing. So what does it take in your perspective?
Well, frankly, I'm very pessimistic about what it takes over actually happening. But fundamentally, we have to realize that neoliberalism and the neoclassical economics in which it's based are a completely false analysis of both human society and a capitalist economy. So we're following a theory which is wrong. If you do what a wrong theory tells you to do, you're bound to make things worse than if you simply STFU and did nothing at all. So in this sense, government policy is actually making capitalism work worse than it would do if they weren't actually trying to manage it, following this false theory. So that's what's necessary. But, you know, we've had 40 years of this, and it's slowly dawning on people that it hasn't worked. But over 40 years, you've lost your manufacturing sector, you've lost your higher education sector in terms of access to people who aren't wealthy. You've lost your health service, et cetera, et cetera. You've got an enormous amount of rebuilding to do. So even if the realization did come that this was a terribly bad way to run an economy, it's been running it for 40 years and it's done a terrible amount of damage, which probably will never be reversed.
Oh, it's a bit of a gloomy way to end, Steve. Oh, and it's never going to be reversed. What do you think, Martin?
Well, I mean, it's an objective analysis that he's making. It's very difficult to see how we can break out of this neoliberal straitjacket, but I think what may cause the situation to transform is, as Steve King points out, it just doesn't work. When Osborne was carrying out his austerity policy, he actually lost the country's AAA credit rating. The whole policy is we're going to restrict spending so that we can keep our credit rating. But what it did is it started to push the economy down, and then the deficit automatically increased and we lost the country's AAA.
Well, it doesn't work for the country, but it does work for the rich.
It does work for the rich, but at the same time, the Sunak's got exactly the same issue to face. It's because, in actual fact, the Bank of England's raising interest rates because inflation is higher in Britain than in other comparable countries. And that means that we are going to go into a recession, probably a depression, which will last for quite a long time until we get a government that's prepared to invest in the country. But to do that, what will probably happen, Sunak will lose the election because the economy is in the doldrums. Starmer will come in and he won't want to invest the necessary money into he won't do the right things. And if he doesn't do the right things, the economy will continue to be mired in depression. And you can't cut your way out of a depression. Ultimately, political forces will emerge saying, look, we've just got to spend some money to get this country back on its feet. And in actual fact, during the COVID pandemic, the government nationalised large chunks of the economy just like that. They can do it, and people saw them do it. So why can't we do it? If we're in a sufficiently bad situation, enough people are going to suddenly realise we couldn't do something about this, but we'll have to get rid of the clowns in charge.
Yeah, but you can't. How can you get rid of the clowns in charge when all you've got is another set of clowns lining up?
Well, we've got to change the electoral system, as I keep banging on about, but it's already been changed in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
But there's still clowns in charge there.
But not the same kind of clowns as in charge in England.
Well, they are clowns. OK, they're not maybe the same kind.
It's not a neoliberal party.
Marty, surely the real problem is the party system, is that these parties are operating like cults and only putting morons in that we can vote for.
That's a very unhistorical analysis, Tony. In actual fact, if you look at, we haven't really discussed the Spanish election, but it's very interesting what's happened there with a proportional system, which was brought in 1975 when they got rid of Franco. And it leads to much more complex politics.
with quite different things going on. So the Socialist Party in Spain, they've got fairly low inflation compared to us. So they've managed that right. And the government in power has managed to cling on to power because, in actual fact, it's made life for people better than it otherwise would have been. And you've got the same effect in Portugal, again, with a proportional system. They had to get rid of the fascists in the 1970s as well. And it's Britain's institutional oligarchy, which has been running this country since, you know, the glorious revolution of 1688. That is why we cannot change. It's a feature, not a bug, of the way the thing is run. And ultimately, what can happen in this is that the state just breaks up. Yeah, like Yugoslavia. People just go their own way. People in Scotland may eventually decide, if we're going to be run by this kind of government in London, which is committed to austerity, there's only one way out for us, which is we have to leave the United Kingdom. And that is their line. That is exactly what they're saying.
Well, it's amazing leaving the United Kingdom, because actually what's happening is people are coming into the United Kingdom across the Channel. There's a lot of these migrants around, which are hopping into these generally inflatable boats and coming across the Channel, all fueled by organised crime. Martin, we've seen over the last week or so, actually last week, it was in the Mediterranean, these boats heading out from Tunisia, a boat with capsized, and 41 people were drowned on that. Then we had last weekend, six died in one of these little channel boats, and apparently it was because the other boats were getting too close to it, although you know, there's all sorts of disputes and doubts about that. Maybe there'll be inquests, maybe not. These people seem to be, their lives seem to be so little value, certainly to the people who are putting them on a boat and shipping them across and taking their money. And then again, we've got the Cape Verde Islands, an even more horrific case there of a boat which was drifting for many days and people dying on it, almost like one of those horrible stories that you hear of people being, you know, a small group of people being shipwrecked and then having to try and, you know, get water when there's no water but seawater around. And that's 60 that died there. So, I mean, you and I both know that these migrants are being shipped around the world by organised crime. And yet you seem to think, Martin, that it's perfectly normal and a good thing.
I don't think it's a good thing, Tony. That's an absurd thing for you to suggest. I think it's an appalling tragedy. It's an appalling tragedy. We've just been discussing the economics of Britain. Britain, through its role in the International Monetary Fund, has forced Thatcherism on all the countries of Africa, all the countries of Eastern Europe.
So is that why these people are coming to Britain then?
No, it's not that. We've also invaded various countries. A lot of the people who died in the Channel were from Afghanistan, where the British Army was handed
Well, what about the people who are actually organising the people trafficking? Apparently they are both Sudanese, and there's been arrests over in France for a change this week, and they're Iraqis and Sudanese.
Okay. Yes, there are criminals involved in this. There are criminals involved in bringing drugs into the country, and we've got a huge bureaucracy. They're trying to stop them, but it doesn't
But
mean-
are they really trying to stop them?
Well, the drugs, depends whether they've got the CIA connections or not, doesn't it, Tony? Yeah. The world is in a crisis.
I mean, we're not actually talking about drugs, although, of course, it is related.
Yes,
this whole migrant problem, it seems to me, is very, very simple, is that the big fascist corporations, we were hearing about fascism earlier, both from Labour fascism and Tory fascism, what they like, these big corporations, is to just have a simple load of cheap labour, so that these people are basically beholden to them, and that means they can sack people at the drop of a hat and send them on to Social Security or whatever, or maybe they get evicted from their homes, and we're ending up with a country where much of the employment is coercive, and the unions are broken by these sorts of tactics where these people are brought over deliberately, aren't they?
Well, let's just put it this way. Asylum seekers who get to this country to make asylum claims are not allowed to work until their claims are
been
processed.
Okay, well, they may be asylum seekers, but these are economic migrants.
Let's talk about economic migrants. The North American Free Trade Agreement, which was signed by the fascist Mexican government, because it wasn't a democratic government at that stage, it was the PRI government, they signed that with the Americans, and they basically opened up their agricultural markets to subsidized U.S. corn, which actually pushed all of the poor farmers in the south of Mexico off the land, which is what the Chiapas uprising was about. Now, the Americans forced that on the Mexicans. The British have forced that through the IMF and through all the things that we do. We forced that on Eastern Europe. We forced that on North America and North Africa. And we've destroyed the economies directly and indirectly also by attacking these countries. Libya, for example, was attacked.
Well, but this isn't the main. I mean, this is complete poppycock, chaos. Martin, it's poppycock. Most of these people are coming over here trafficked by organised crime. I mean, for example, it's a fact. That it is organised crime trafficking these people.
How are we going to stop them, Tony?
Well, I would say the most sensible way. Martin, no, it's very, very simple. Very simple. You take the profit motive out of the organised crime that's doing it. I mean, what you've got is, have a think. I'm sure you're not stupid. You're not stupid. One of the things you can do, which is really, really easy, really simple thing to do, is you arrest the people who are organising these.
Oh, right. Like we arrest all the heads of the drug cartels as well. But does it stop the drugs coming in? No, it doesn't. Because if there's a market, it's an economic argument.
The reason they're not arrested, as you know, is that the French, for example, with our channel migrants are complicit with this. They have no problem with it. In fact, the police will watch as a double decker turns up full of migrants and a guy with a big 4x4 and three of these boats on the back of it turns up, and then those people from the double decker bus get in and off they go. And the French police are just sitting there smoking their cigarettes.
What you've been saying all along, Tony, is we could send our customs people, our people over there, and just process them in France.
That's the obvious thing to do, anyway. But you don't agree with these organised crime ringleaders of these, the masterminds. Then no, that even though we've got this week 110 people, this week 110 people have died off on these boats. But you think it's okay to not bother trying to arrest the ringleaders?
And arrest them, but I still won't. You still won't solve the problem. You're not going to solve the problem of drugs either by arresting people for using drugs, because it's not going to go away. What's happened, and it's going to carry on happening. Think of all the millions of people that have fled from the Ukraine.
I think what you'll find is that the four people smugglers that have been arrested today in France will not be the ringleaders. And this is what you need to do.
That's right. So in other words, you're not going to get the ringleaders. So
What I'm saying is
I'm not against enforcement, Tony.
Yeah, well, good. So that means why aren't they enforcing it? Of course, the French authorities know who these people are, but they don't arrest them.
Oh, for goodness sake, Tony, you just want this to be a solvable problem. And it isn't a solvable problem until what the African countries are going to do with this coup in Niger is it may be that with the help of the Russians and the Chinese, they may be about to repudiate all of their international debts denominated in dollars.
Well, that would be fantastic. Let's hope they do, yeah.
Yes, but if they do that, that's the banking system down the drain in the West. And, of course, this ultimately is the only way to stop people coming to the West, is that to give them a future in their own country.
Well, that would be far better, wouldn't it?
Much better. But the first thing you've got to do is smash the International Monetary Fund, which is exactly what's going to be discussed.
I think, anecdotally, obviously they get treated very well when they first arrive, which is, you know, no problem with that at all. Why not put people up? Absolutely brilliant. No problem. But the thing is, after a while, they find that they are often working for more organised crime gangs here in the UK. And so this is a kind of... I think we're living in a world now, as you know, with the City of London, Martin, and the consistent fraud that's always going on. We're living in... And David Southwell, who was speaking a couple of weeks ago, was saying something very similar. That organised crime is really in charge. That any kind of illusion that they're not running the show these days is rubbish. And actually they are. And that the government is on the back foot, particularly the Home Office. They're not. It's not that they don't know what's going on. It's just that they are afraid to take on these people because they're far too powerful.
These people that you're talking of are in the City of London, Tony. They are the criminals. They're the ones behind Gladio and all the rest of it.
Yes, well, I'm not disagreeing with you at all, no.
So, in other words, we're going to have a major war now. It's already started. The COVID pandemic was indeed a pandemic. And what happens in wars, I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia. When people come to your house with a gun, you run away. You do. You don't think twice. You pick your stuff up and you run. And that's what's going to happen. That's what's happened in Libya. In Syria, all of the Arab countries have agreed to drop sanctions on Syria. Guess who isn't dropping sanctions on Syria? We're not dropping sanctions on Syria. So people from Syria can't go home to Syria because there's nothing there for them. So they're on these boats coming to Britain because of our policy of sanctions on Syria. And if we wanted them not to come, we could just lift sanctions on Syria and make peace.
Well, I mean, having crossed the border over from Mexico with a whole bunch of Mexicans, not illegally, I might add, into the United States. Well, actually, they were just travelling up to the border, the people I was travelling with. They see it as an adventure. This is a way to get some money for my family.
But the Mexican small farmers were destroyed by the North American Free Trade Agreement. They've driven off the land. The Ayudos, which used to distribute land to everybody after the Mexican Revolution.
These people were the people I was travelling with, Martin. They were just in it for the money and the adventure. And who can blame them? Why shouldn't they try and go get better life?
Don't forget that border on the Rio Grande was created by the Americans invading Mexico in the 1830s.
But look, answer
they didn't
the question.
Control any of that area.
What is the problem? Why shouldn't they try and get a better life?
Well, they're going to come and try and get a better life, whatever you like, whether you like it or not. There's possibly, if climate change is a thing, let's not go down that wormhole, people are going to have to leave where they live now and go somewhere else. And, of course, all of the war and chaos that's been created by the deep state in the West since 9/11 has put – there are more refugees today than at the end of the Second World War. That's because we're in the Third World War.
We are. No, you're quite right. Well, one of the things refugees that you keep hearing – it's rather irritating the way you just characterise me. Oh, you're just saying what the Tories say. No, actually, I'm just saying what I think is going on. It may be that the Tories are saying the similar thing, but it's not. I'm not saying it in any way because I'm a Tory, you know, which is one of those things you like to try and characterise. And one of the things the Tories do want to do is want to get rid of the Human Rights Act because apparently this is one of the things which is helping these migrants stay. But I spoke to our Glasgow correspondent, I suppose we can call her. She's far more than that, obviously. Natalie Minnis this week, because she's rather concerned about the new Human Rights Act that is being brought in by the Scottish Parliament.
The new Human Rights Act is coming along for just Scotland, as I understand it, which I didn't know about.
I think that that England had a separate consultation. So this consultation is for a Human Rights Act for Scotland, and it's open until October. And it sounds wonderful. I mean, who doesn't want human rights or think that human rights are important? And when I started looking through the consultation, I really felt that it was twisting the idea of human rights. It seemed to be focusing a lot, putting a lot of focus on the idea of the right to a healthy environment. So that's just one example. But it was really, really reinforcing this idea. And again, everyone wants a healthy environment. It's very important. But is this actually a human right? Surely human rights should be something that people can use really to hold the government to account. The idea of human rights sort of stems back to the French Revolution or maybe the American Revolution before that, the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the Bill of Rights. And although obviously Americans had slavery at the same time, so their human rights philosophies weren't exactly perfect. But that's really the idea, that it's about people, the first right, I think, in the UK, the UN Declaration of Human Rights was followed the Second World War, and it was about the right to life, the right to religious freedom. That was obviously really important to the Americans. But when you get the right to a healthy environment...
There are some other very important rights in there, like the right to shelter, the right to food, the right to work, all these kinds of things, and many of those are called been eroded. And a right, by the way, a right means it's something you're entitled to without paying for it. You know, if you don't have any money, you still have that right. And so we're moving into a world where the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was put together after World War II to enshrine in international law the sorts of things that we saw the Nazis getting rid of.
The right to life.
Yeah, the right to life, obviously, that sort of thing. These sorts of things, it seems, are just kind of falling away right now.
Yeah, I don't know that they're falling away. It's just as they're being maybe, I feel as if that's those basic rights are being used to encourage people to think that this is all a really good thing. But then as you get deeper into this Human Rights Act for Scotland, you come across the minimum core obligations, which really is about the duty holders. The government has to be held to this. And towards the end of this act, it says that it gives a case study of the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And when you get something like that, maybe I would call it maybe a civil right rather than a human right, because it's something that you could have put so many different interpretations on. And there's a whole list of things under this case study, the right to the highest attainable standards of physical and mental health. And one of the categories is immunisation against major infectious diseases. And does that mean that everyone has a right to immunisation, or does it mean that there's a minimum core obligation to be immunised? I mean, this isn't, it starts getting less and less clear. And I think there's a real danger that human rights could be used actually as a lever of control. This is what concerns me.
Well, this is one thing that was coming out during the pandemic was this whole idea of, well, if you haven't been vaccinated, then you don't have the right to go near people who have.
Yeah, exactly. And that could fall under the idea of the right to a healthy environment. And another thing that could fall under that is whether you're allowed to drive your car. They might say that, well, you know, encroaching on people's human rights if you drive a petrol or diesel car, for example. So I just think that and the other thing is that it comes from the UN. It's the UN that has the blueprint for this, and this has been discussed at length and filtered into a document called SNAP2. That's the acronym. Which I hate that acronym as well. It's like snap to it or something. And I think it's well-meaning. I've read through this SNAP2 document, and there are many good things in it. For example, it talks about the right to bodily integrity. But there's so many different interpretations. Basic right, human rights are about the right to life, the right to religious freedom, the right to equality, and things that you can't really argue with. And that the government, you can hold the government to account for that. But when it comes to these things like health is one topic, or environment, so many different things could be read into that. That we've got to be really careful.
Mental health, I mean, one person's insanity is another person's wisdom. You know, it really is. And in fact, it's even enshrined in much of the psychiatric literature that there isn't really any actual proper definition of what makes somebody mentally ill. And so, you know, this is beginning to sound a little bit Orwellian, Natalie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I definitely agree about that. You need something that's more detailed. You can't just leave it up to interpretation by the courts. Otherwise, it's I don't know what it would be, maybe a civil right or a type of law. It doesn't mean that, I mean, obviously we do want mental health to be prioritised, but, you know, it's
almost undefined. This is the trouble. And of course, it doesn't really matter.
Undefined.
If you haven't got anywhere to live and you haven't got any food. You know,
And there's another category, the right to say it's social security. And again, you know, it's fine to have a safety net, but is this a human right? What does it actually mean for people? Is it going to mean the ushering in of a universal basic income? And if so, then what would be the criteria for that? Would you have to be have certain medical treatments in order to receive the universal basic income, for example? There's so many, it just raises a lot of questions. And I just feel that at the moment, I feel personally speaking, my own experience from being made redundant in 2009 is that the social security system seemed to be a kind of lever of control to kind of nudge me towards taking a job that I didn't really want to take. You know, many people would argue that that's nonsense, but that was my personal experience. And I think I feel that many of these things that are painted in as being beneficial can be twisted and used to control people.
Yeah, so that's Natalie Minnis, blogger extraordinaire, speaking to me, a mountaineer, speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, what do you make of this whole business? Actually, one of the interesting things she's saying there is that the idea that you're going to have to get your universal basic income from the government, or more and more millions of people are going to be doing that in the future, is an interesting one as the small and medium businesses collapse, as the economy slowly collapses. And that UBI is going to be rather, you know, you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z before you're going to get the money.
Well, there are various ways of thinking about UBI. If we're talking about UBI rather than human rights in general, I would argue you've got to make it a citizen's income. So it's not a universal basic income. It's given to citizens. And if you're a citizen, you must fulfill only one obligation. You must vote in elections. And otherwise you can't have it. And you give it to everybody, and it can't be taken away, and it's absolutely unconditional.
That sounds too good to be true, doesn't it, in a way?
Well, that's what you've got to fight for. What we've got at the moment is a benefits system where you are coerced by the benefits system. And it's not to do with them having computers. They used to coerce you when it was all card file indexes. The benefits system is designed for the capitalist class. You know, we'll keep these people alive as long as we can bully them into doing something we want them to do. And that's why we need a citizen's income, to give people the right to tell their bosses where they can stick it. And, of course, if you want that, you've got to fight for it, because they ain't going to give it you.
No, they certainly won't. So, anyway, also I spoke to Natalie, and the full interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where she also talks about some of her experiences mountaineering. Is also spoke to her about the policy making behind much of our climate. Of course, this climate legislation came in 2008, much of it, with Ed Miliband in charge, and at least he was the minister who was in charge of it at the time. And it's like those chickens are coming home to roost, because a lot of these laws are now starting to kick in. Oh dear, you're going to have to put planters right across your streets because we don't want you to be able to drive from one end of the street to the other. We've seen some horrific things this week. For example, I don't know if anyone else has seen it, but there's a footage photographs of cul-de-sacs where people are having these ULEZ cameras installed. I think this is, to me, an absolute massive battle between Sadiq Khan, the World Economic Forum, and the people of London, because there's an increasing movement of individuals who are basically taking direct action. What they're doing is they're getting in ladders, they're going up the lampposts in their street, and they're going chop, 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 and they're cutting down these ULEZ cameras because they are aware that this is not only is it a way of road charging everybody for every time they go down the road, which they don't want to do, quite obviously, and this is a completely undemocratic policy, but they're also under surveillance, and this is turning the country into a kind of Orwellian nightmare state by trying to put everybody under surveillance. So there's the anti-democratic aspect of it, number one, and all these protests going on about this and Khan taking no notice of them, but then there's also this mass surveillance society aspect to it too. Spoke to Natalie about where these policies are coming from. And in the UK, what we've got is we've got something called the Committee on Climate Change, which is the main, a little bit like we had during the pandemic, that SAGE committee, if you remember, making these crucial, important decisions. And many of those people, of course, were part of the industry, vaccine industry, such as the boss of the Wellcome Trust, who has now become the chief scientific advisor at the World Health Organization, Jeremy Farrar. And the Wellcome Trust, I think, is always worthwhile. I mean, if you're ever in London, go and have a look at their creepy museum, which is open for free. It's on the Euston Road near the London's Friends Meeting House. And they are a fascinating organisation. But that's the sort of thing that has been formulating these policies. Anyway, the Committee on Climate Change is a kind of SAGE, but for all this climate policy.
the Committee on Climate Change, which I didn't really even know existed. Now, this is something which is trying to and successfully bringing in policy. It's a government committee, I believe.
It's, I think it's a quangle. I think they advise a government. I came across it in 2021 during the COP26, the environmental conference in Glasgow. And I noticed that this headline on the BBC saying, "Make people fly less, ministers told." And I just found that such a shocking headline. I thought, who are these people that are telling ministers, government ministers, in a so-called democracy, to make people fly less? And that's how I found out about this Committee on Climate Change. It's described as an advisory body. The current head is John Selwyn Gummer. I didn't think that he was, a member of Extinction Rebellion or anything. It's, his former Conservative minister. Yeah, John Selwyn Gummer, he was a Conservative Party chairman in the 1980s and Secretary of State for the Environment in the 1990s. And the other members include Nick Chater, the Professor of Behavioural Science at the Warwick Business School and a member of the Behavioural Insights team, the famous Nudge Unit that was so active during the pandemic.
Oh, God, we had one of these Warwick Business School people at Bilderberg back in May over in Lisbon too. They seem to be a sort of nest of vipers in there.
Yes, And I think some of the other members are genuine, but, well, they probably all are genuine, but they're not really kind of grassroots campaigners, environmental campaigners.
So what's the agenda, do you think?
I get the impression it's quite a corporate type of agenda. It seems that they're, I'm just looking down the list of members, because there's also Dr. Rebecca Heaton, who had stepped down following questions over her position as senior executive with Drax, which is a large biomass power station. Yeah, so she stepped down from the committee due to a conflict of interest and was appointed as the new Director of Sustainability for OVO Energy. Piers Forster, who's a Professor of Physical Climate Change and Director of the Priestley International Centre for Climate at the University of Leeds, and he was Principal Investigator of the Integrated Assessment of Geoengineering Proposals, and a trustee of the UK Rainforest Protection Charity, the United Bank of Carbon. And I think people like that are probably think they're doing a lot of good, but it does have a very sort of corporate financial side to it.
You can also guarantee that many of these bodies are funded by, these tax-free foundations such as Carnegie, Rockefeller.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying it's those specific ones, but there is a network of tax-free foundations, many of them American, some of them British too, that are effectively running a kind of parallel government.
Yes, definitely. There's another member of this Committee for Climate Change or on Climate Change is James Ferguson Skia, CBEFRSA, Professor of Sustainable Energy at Imperial College London Centre for Environmental Policy, and a member of the Bureau of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And he's also served as a non-executive director of BlackRock New Energy Investment Trust, PLC, since 2009. And he is vice president of the Energy Institute and sits on the advisory board of the Scott Institute for Energy Innovation at Carnegie Mellon University.
Ah. So I wonder whether many green activists, your XR types, that have any idea that so many policymakers who are connected with these, massive like private equity firms like BlackRock, for example.
Yes, it just seems like a sort of cozy little club, really, who probably all really think they're doing great things for the earth. But it's really about feathering each other's nests, I think. It's keeping corporate agenda going.
Yes, feathering each other's nests. Maybe they want to believe that they're doing something for the planet, Martin. But clearly, you know, having one of the bosses of the Drax power station, which is, you know, chopping down trees and feeding them in to make electricity, and one of the bosses of BlackRock, this committee, I think, you know, I'm going to give her a little round of... Well done, Natalie, for digging out these conflicts of interest that they are. This is what they are at the heart of British climate change policy.
Well, I mean, they, as we know, the financial sector, like BlackRock, they've taken over the Federal Reserve in the United States. They're embedded in everything. They own everything, directly or indirectly. And of course, they're the ones who are pushing their green industrial revolution, fourth industrial revolution, as the solution to climate change. And whatever you think about climate change, they ain't the solution to anything. They are the problem. And we're having a massive social breakdown is going on around us. And these people hope to be the disaster capitalists to make money off it. And they are behind it all. But they'll have, you know, ultimately, it's when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller.
So what do you think, can you try and answer my question? Do you think most of these XR activists realise that private equity is, you know, one of the major influences in actually implementing this policy? I mean, for example, I know that these hedge funds and private equity firms are doing an enormous amount of buying up of land because they stand to gain an enormous amount through this carbon offset scheme, which is this carbon trading business of King Charles's. They're buying up this land, meaning that farmers can't own it, and suddenly the value of land in Wales and other places is starting to shoot up because suddenly there's a massive market for these people to buy this stuff up and plant trees on it.
Well, I don't believe in carbon offsetting. I mean, it's just a scam, isn't it? Let's face it. But of course, what's actually happening?
Why?
Because if you want to stop carbon emissions, you have to actually stop carbon emissions, not offset your carbon emissions by planting trees. You need a plan, not a market. What they've done is they've created a pseudo market in carbon offsets.
Well, hang on, Martin. What they're saying is what they're saying effectively is we can't change things overnight. So the companies that are using a lot of not using carbon, that are emitting a lot of carbon, what we'll do is we'll soften the blow by not by taxing them financially, but by taxing them in a specific way which is designed to mitigate against that carbon, i.e. planting trees.
No, well, you could just say, if you're emitting too much carbon, we're going to reduce your carbon emissions. This is a way of avoiding that. So in other words, they can carry on polluting, provided they've planted some trees in Wales, which of course is, you know, and it's actually a pseudo market. Yeah, it's only created by the government deciding that you can carry on. You could just do a plan and say, right, well, we're going to reduce your carbon emissions. But that means we go bankrupt. All that, we will nationalise you then.
Well, is there any point of doing this if we're not doing it across the world? Is there any point in just one country doing it?
Listen, there are global problems which will require global coordination to deal with. But we have to deal with them without this fantasy that everything has a market solution. And all we've got to do is get the prices right, and then the financial masses of the universe will save the planet for us. We need to get rid of the financial masses of the universe. This is exactly what's going to be discussed in Johannesburg at the end of this month, because they're moving towards, we've got to get rid of Western finance, not give them more money to plant trees. And of course, if Africa does decide not to pay its dollar-denominated debts, as Michael Hudson has suggested, that should crash the City of London. And then we'll have to decide what we're going to do with our little bit of the planet.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll be deciding. I mean, what we'll be deciding is that, oh, we're going to have to go over to a new system of money called central bank digital currencies. Isn't that the case, Martin?
Well, I think that what the powers that be are doing is preparing their version of the future for us after the, you know, we all know there's going to be a crisis. They're doing the classic disaster capitalist thing of saying, oh, there's a crisis now, let's do this. But of course, what we should be doing is saying, yes, there's a crisis now, let's get rid of you.
Yeah, I think we need to look very, very closely, and we're going to be doing that right now at the central bank digital currencies One of the things I Nick taught me this week in his interview is that what they're considering is having a currency, Martin, where, for example, they can pay £1,000 into Martin Summers' bank account. This can come as a payment, which will only last a month, and you've got to spend it in a month. And if you don't spend it in a month, it disappears.
Well, that's very similar to the stamp scrip issued in Vogel in Austria as a local currency in the 1930s in order to get rid of the depression. Now, in other words, what you do, you can, and this is a possibility, is if you've got a situation where a community is in depression, there's no people are saving, basically, because they're worried about unemployment and so on. If you issued the mayor of Vogel in Austria issued people, they could pay their local taxes in it, but you had to spend it. You couldn't just stick it under the mattress. And in actual fact, it worked, and the local economy started to pick up. But then the Austrian Central Bank stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. Now, in other words, these things are technically possible, but the question is, what's the motivation behind it?
If you wanted to kickstart the economy, you could suddenly give people a whole load of money that had a sell-by date on that they had to use immediately.
Well, it's what they used to call helicopter money, yeah? This is Ben Bernanke, helicopter money. I mean, this is it, when we got into the crash and we're mired in depression, people will be coming up with ideas for putting everybody back to work. Mm. And this is where the arguments will come.
Well, looking down our high streets, I wonder if we're already getting there. We seem to be. Not only did COVID really hit small and medium businesses, and you found the big multinationals like Amazon doing incredibly well out of it, the same is happening with this cost of living crisis and the whacking up of interest rates, isn't it?
It is. And it's all because we decided to go to war with Russia and not buy their stuff.
Is it really? I mean, that's certainly a line which is being sold.
It's not Putin's fault. The Russians were quite happy to sell us gas at a reasonable price. They were preparing to work with Germany for the next 40 or 50 years to both mutual advantage.
Well, can't somebody like British Gas or
the pipeline, and that's the end of that.
Can't British Gas or OVO Energy or somebody send a few tankers over to pick up some of this cheap stuff from Russia? Maybe bring it up, round the top or through the Baltic or something.
We're supposed to be having sanctions on Russia.
The Russians are quite happy to sell us stuff.
We just don't want
to
buy it.
You know what might happen? They might be chugging back and so they're getting towards one of these container ports or whatever, or maybe Tyneside or somewhere where they dock to unload the gas. A US submarine might just pop up in front of them.
Well, I mean, nobody. The rest of the world has ignored our sanctions on Russia. Nobody outside Europe has sanctioned Russia. What the European elites have done at the behest of the Americans is basically commit harakiri, economic harakiri. Europe is going to go into a massive depression now. And it's all self-inflicted by just going along with what the Americans want.
Yeah, well, we invaded
Iraq to keep them happy.
Over the last few weeks...
They live next door to Iraq. They live 10,000 miles away.
Over the last few weeks, we've been hearing from various people, not Nigel Farage, thank goodness, who've had their bank accounts shut down, particularly from Debbie Hicks, who was a pro-cash campaigner, and also Louise Creffield from Save Our Rights, which got nearly 1 million people out onto the streets in London in 2021 as a big demonstration against the lockdowns. But, you know, having their bank accounts shut is really dodgy. Of course it is. Being cancelled in a different way to not being told that you're not allowed to speak or you're going to be booted out of some organisation. Yes, the bank is booting you out. So, but anyway, we're looking obviously at this whole thing of central bank digital currencies coming down the line. One of the things when I spoke to Nick Corbishley, he's the author of Scanned, which is, I mean, and he finishes up this, I think it's a fascinating little section with Nick, explaining that actually the central bank digital currencies are completely tied up with having a digital identity. So the idea is you've got a kind of microchip or some kind of something similar which you use for identifying, saying, yes, I'm me, you know, a little bit like your Nazi papers, and for doing financial transactions too. So anyway, here's an excerpt of my chat with Nick Corbishley about central bank digital currencies and about this whole cancel culture, about what is the point, and particularly the various countries like India and Ukraine and Nigeria and China, where they are being right now trialed.
this is where the debanking scandal that has happened over the last couple of months in the UK is so important, because it shows that banks, even in the current system, are quite content when they are presented with what they consider is a risky customer. They are quite content to simply close that customer's account down. And in some cases in the US, if you are, you know, if you have your bank account closed down, that would actually mean that you can't even access your account, your money, for a certain period of time. And it may be actually quite a long period of time. So if you can imagine a system where it's almost like it would be AI managed, artificial intelligence managed, you could suddenly find yourself wanting to buy, I don't know, pay for a meal in a restaurant or whatever, and suddenly your account no longer exists. For some reason, your money can be stopped, that purchase can be stopped, or your account can be frozen. And I can imagine a world in which where you have central bank digital currencies, where it's an almost more impersonal system, where you would have to not only discuss this, well, you'd have to go to your local bank account, your local bank to discuss this, you would have to find somebody at the central bank to broach why it is your money has suddenly stopped, why your bank account is no longer usable. Other possible uses of programmable money that have been suggested would be having money that has an expiration date, so that you could encourage people to spend money more readily, more quickly, rather than saving it. So you could maybe in a recession, central banks could inject money into people's bank accounts, but they would have only a certain period of time to spend that money. Alternatively, what the scary thing is that you could suddenly find your money suddenly being taken out of your bank account. So it is an incredible amount of power to be giving to, I would say, central banks and governments that have not exactly behaved in ways that should generate our trust over decades, I would argue, but certainly over the last few years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it reflects, I suppose, the power, balance of power between the banks and our elected governments, particularly here in Britain. I mean, we've got, after 2008 wasn't the only bailout, there were further bailouts in 2019, which weren't so much talked about. And, you know, it seems that when the banks stamp their feet, throw their toys out of the pram, whenever they do that and say, look, you know, things are going really badly for us, if you don't give us some money, the cash points are going to stop working and people's bank accounts are going to be robbed. You know, they're basically loads of money will be taken out of, you know, so the government really doesn't want this. And so they just do what the banks seem to want. it does seem as if this whole agenda is coming through. Yes, it's good for the banks, but that there's been very little democratic input. But look, also, I think we owe it to the rest of the world to look around a little bit to see what's going on in other countries. And I know in Nigeria, quite a lot's been happening, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Nigeria is the first largest, or was the first largest economy to launch a central bank digital currency, the so-called e-Naira, which was, I think, in October 2021. And I think it's a really interesting case study that, again, is just not getting the attention it probably deserves. So Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa. It's the most populous country in Africa. And it's the, and like I said, it's the first country to launch a central bank digital currency. And the first year or so, it was an incredible flop. It didn't reach anywhere near the kind of circulation, the amount of customer use that it was hoping for. Fewer than a million people had downloaded the application in a country of 230 million, and most of those were not using it. So I mean, like, they downloaded that. So it was a disaster. The IMF, even the IMF came out and said, you know, this is not working well. So in around about October last year, the government, which conveniently was the first year anniversary of its launch, the central bank and the government began talking about the need to do a demonetization program, which is something that countries from time to time do. They withdraw certain notes from circulation in order to replace them with other notes, with new notes. And India probably carried out the most famous or the most infamous demonetization program in 2016, when they withdrew 84%, if I'm not mistaken, of the cash in circulation with zero warning, causing absolute devastation. That was in India in 2016. Nigeria gave a little bit more warning, but what they essentially did was, in January this year, they began telling people to come in and bring in their cash, the high denomination notes they had. And in Nigeria, when you have a high denomination note, that basically, I think it's like 10 quid, it's probably less than that now, because Nigeria has very, very high inflation and its currency is constantly losing value. So, I mean, they told people to bring in their high denomination notes, which they did, but they didn't have any new notes to give them back. And this is when they started to have serious economic problems. They withdrew more than half of the cash from the system, and they didn't put any new money in. And this caused, as happened in India in 2016, this caused huge problems. Businesses went out of business. People were not able to pay for their most basic things. They were not able to pay for their medical bills. They were not able to pay for their prescription medicines. They were not able to pay for anything. This caused huge. So you had huge protests. You had burning downs of, people burnt down bank branches, and the Supreme Court got involved and told the central bank, look, you've got to stop this experiment. You've got to get this money back in. And the central bank, for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, refused. Basically disobeyed the Supreme Court. So when we talk about power, I mean, this was an enormous statement. This was a central bank saying, we are going to ignore the Supreme Court. And they carried on with this program until eventually they backed down.
So when people brought in their high denomination notes, what were they getting in return? Some sort of on their central bank digital currency app on their phone?
No, I mean, it was, as far as I was aware, they were going in, they were giving in their money. I presume the bank was taking note of the money they'd received, but they weren't getting anything in return. So the idea of this, I mean, there were two things happening. So first of all, the central bank desperately wanted people to start using e-naira. The madness of this is that most people in Nigeria cannot use the e-naira even if they wanted to, because most people don't have a bank account and most people don't have a smartphone. So from day one, it was absolutely flawed. So people were taking in their money and they were getting nothing in return. And it was an absolute scandal, yet it was not getting reported anywhere. I mean, I think I was, even in the alternative media, I was one of the few people who actually consistently reported. I mean, I did like 5 or 6 articles about what happened in Nigeria. So, I mean, the other reason why this happened was because the central bank governor in Nigeria wanted to be president of Nigeria. He was tired of being central bank governor and he wanted the top job, and elections were coming. So he presented himself in the primaries for the leading party, the governing party, and he lost against one of his bitter rivals. And leading up to the election, which was, I think, in February, they basically announced that day when the deadline, the cutoff point was for introducing your money, so taking your money to the bank. Now, after that deadline, you know, any money you took in would not even be registered. His thinking was that this bitter rival of his almost all of his electoral machinery was based around buying votes. So if they could take cash out of the system, then his bitter rival would not be able to buy votes in the elections and would lose. Which, I mean, like, it's insane. It's one person's political ambitions allowing, basically triggering, being used to deprive a country of 220 million of half of their money supply. And I mean, Nigeria is a country that depends on cash, just like most emerging or developing countries do. And we don't really know how many people died as a direct result of this, but we know people did because they were unable to get healthcare.
Well, it sounds a bit like Ukraine. You know, obviously Ukraine is in more ways than just financially, but, you know, being used as almost a playground by the the central bankers. What about India? And you mentioned India briefly there, but I know these things are moving forward in China, and China, of course, is notorious for its social credit system, where they profile everybody, and certain people are considered good citizens, others bad citizens, and so, you know, some can do things and others can't. Say, for example, use air travel or the bullet trains and this kind of thing. So how's things going in China and India?
Well, they're moving along. I mean, they're leading the way, I would say. I mean, like, the e-Naira has so far been a disaster, but China is taking a much more incremental approach to this. So China began its CBDC plan almost 10 years ago in 2014. And like its social credit system, it is developing this in a kind of very careful, very considered manner, launching when the Chinese government thinks the system is more or less ready, they will launch it in very small localities, then they will expand it. And as far as I'm aware, the digital yuan pilot programs are now in 22-23 different parts of China. Those could be cities, those could be regions. So I mean, like, it's at a point where I think China could any moment more or less just launch it nationwide. So that is China. India is a bit further behind, but they're also at the pilot stage for the digital rupee. India has a massive advantage over most Western countries, which is that it has the biggest digital identity, biometrically enabled digital identity program on the planet, with almost 1.4 billion, 1.4 billion people involved. I think that the number of people now in India who are not on the so-called Aadhaar database is probably less than 5%. So if you are going to launch a central bank digital currency, you absolutely need a digital identity program fully established and fully functioning. And this is, in the case of China and India, both have that. And I think this is one of the reasons why they're kind of like leagues ahead of the countries, most of the countries in the West. But I mean, you'll see, I mean, like, everywhere you look right now, you will see that, you know, any country that is at the development stage of central bank digital currency is also developing or even rolling out a digital identity system. So the two things go hand in hand.
Well, thank you, Nick Corbishley, for informing us about the progress of this, the way this is going around the world. And, you know, this is something that we should be beginning on our mainstream press the whole time. The fact of the matter is, Martin, this whole convergence of digital ID and your bank account is rather worrying. The idea is here that you're going to have some sort of digital system. And if you don't have that digital system with you, maybe an implantable chip, that sort of thing, you can't basically do anything. You can't pay a toll, you can't buy food, you can't work, all that sort of stuff. And I suppose there may become an economy which is extraneous to that, where people are just simply using barter the whole time. So the money system, it seems to me, along with the digital identity system, this kind of where are your papers, please, in an electronic form, a bitter, it's looming, isn't it? This is something that elites want, and they actually are effectively treating us like cattle.
Well, you can see that the problem they've got with this is they tried to introduce it in Nigeria, and it didn't work.
Yeah, but he says, it's ready to go almost in China.
Yes, but that's because the Chinese have approached it in a different way. What they're developing a digital currency for is because they need, ultimately, they need people to keep their money in China rather than taking it out of the country. So they've got capital.
That's not
control.
Why they're doing it. They're doing it because they want to be able to punish people that don't behave themselves.
No, not everybody. Nobody is forced to adopt a digital central currency, digital central bank currency in China. It's an option.
Not now. No, he's saying it's ready to go.
Yes, and they're trialling it in various cities where people can use a digital bank currency if they want.
I mean, do you not see the totalitarian fascistic aspects to this?
Possibilities, Tony, but that's not what the Chinese are doing. They could make it into a totalitarian setup, but then they had a pretty totalitarian setup in Maoist China where nobody had any electronic equipment at all. It's just your neighbours grassing you up. Intention is everything with all of this stuff. What's happened in India and in Nigeria is that the Western bankers have tried to experiment on these big countries to see if they can get these countries to get rid of cash, which, if you think about it, is an absolutely insane thing to try and do in either country where most people don't have a bank account. How can you have a digital national currency where most people don't have a bank account? It won't work, will it? But, of course, they tried to do it. Because they are trying to push this for their own reasons, as you know, it's very sinister for all the reasons that people realise. But they've got a problem because A, it ain't going to work. You know, no drug dealer in anywhere in Latin America is going to use digital currency. Of course they're not. They're just not going to do it. You can try and get rid of cash, but then you crash your economy and therefore potentially lose elections or create civil wars. In China, they are developing a digital currency as part of lots of other things they're developing. AI, robots, all sorts, which is exactly why the West is determined to bring them down now before they get too much of an advantage. But, of course, they're not forcing it on anybody. It's just an option.
No, not right now. I think you're right. But you see, what's going to happen is, they're not forcing Chinese people to leave the countryside and go into the city. They're just saying that you're going to have a much, much better life if you do.
Well, in actual fact, what's interesting about China is you can't just leave the countryside and go to the city without permission. Because that's always been the case in China, even under the Chinese Empire.
Well, I think it's being very much encouraged. I think you know that.
No, what happens is people go, but then they haven't got big shanty towns around the major cities because they control residence permits.
Well, in fact, what they've got is the opposite. They've got massive housing estates standing empty.
Well, indeed. And, you know, what may well happen, I've been reading this week, there's a very good article by Engdahl on Global Research.
Oh, brilliant.
It's quite possible that the property bubble in China is about to burst. And if it does burst, that will wreck the Chinese economy.
But it surely, look, Martin, I don't think it will. It won't wreck the Chinese economy as much as a property bubble bursting would wreck ours, would it?
Oh, it may do, because it's got...
I mean, surely the Chinese economy is far more government-controlled, and they've got a much better handle on it than ours have. Our government have.
Well, I think this is actually something that I'm reading about and debating in my mind at the moment.
Yeah.
People like Michael Hudson point out that, in actual fact, because the banks in China are state-owned, they could, in fact, just cancel all these debts ultimately, and that may be what they'll have to do. But in the short run, it's local government have issued all of these bonds and they've got all these real estate companies which are on the verge of bankruptcy. Now, if there was, you know, we're probably going to have a housing crash in this country, but it's going to be as bad or worse in China because they're bigger, you know.
if they have an earthquake, it's going to be massive.
Anyway, Nick Corbishley is on Twitter. He's also done a book called Scanned, if you're interested in catching up. I mean, it's great to be able to do updates with him because he's keeping a really good eye on this stuff as it's developing around the world. I mean, do you want to just say something about Ukraine, Martin? Because, you know, Ukraine is a country where this whole idea of digital money is being completely embraced and rolled out. In fact, they've got completely got rid of cash in Ukraine.
Well, they're trying to.
I suppose they may be rubles dollars. And dollars being used. I don't know about rubles, but certainly dollars being used.
Well, and possibly rubles as well. Obviously, the ruble took a bit of a wobble this week. And it may be that the global capitalist system, which does include Russia, China and the West, is simultaneously going to implode in all three regions. It would be nice to think that the Chinese and the Russians have done enough to protect themselves from that, but it might not be the case. The Russians will probably be in the best situation in that because they've got all the resources they need and they're well organised, so they'll survive.
Yeah, if you're as pleased to come across Nick Corbishley as I was, his book is called Scanned, Why Vaccine Passports and Digital IDs Will Mean the End of Privacy and Personal Freedom. It was published in 2022 last year, and so, you know, I'm going to do my best to do regular updates with Nick, and I've encouraged him, you know, every time you see something which is outrageous, interesting and new for our listeners, to ping me too, so we, you know, hopefully we're going back to him for reasonably regular updates. But we're going to finish the first part this week by looking at this struggle. Well, it's an interesting battle, really, going down in near Lyme Regis at a place called Monkton Wild Court. And it's a former school, which was is the headquarters for the Land magazine. Now, they're now potentially looking for a new headquarters because some new trustees that turned up at the beginning of this year have decided to evict Simon Fairley, who he came out with his last year with his, well, he called it a memoir, which is almost like something you produce after you've died, but it's really an autobiography and a fascinating read too, called Going to Seed. It was reviewed in The Guardian and various other places. But Simon, you know, he's been confronting George Monbiot, who's an old friend of both of us, over this business of getting rid of livestock and livestock farming. And so there's some interesting stuff in the latest edition of his magazine, The Land. But the most interesting stuff is the procedures by which these trustees have managed to get onto this board of trustees and now try and get rid of all the people that built the place up. I mean, Simon and Jill turned up in the mid-noughties, I think it was, and the place was a bit dilapidated, a lot of rubbish everywhere, and they helped clear it up. They've been building new buildings there, including a nice timber frame part of their farmyard and this sort of thing, and now they find, oh, these new people have turned up with links to Deloitte and KPMG, and they want to just boot Simon out and his magazine too. So there is a what they call resistance festival going on down there next weekend. That's the last weekend in August and the first weekend in September. What they call that, and a resistance festival. Place to find that is at Monkton Wild Court Case. That's WYLD with no E, monktonwildcourtcase.co.uk, or maybe .org.uk. I think it's .co.uk actually. You'll see that you can book courses and things like that down there. It's sort of farming courses. But I mean, this is, I'll put a link up to their fascinating tale of how the Land came to face eviction, which is in the latest edition of The Land, written by Simon Fairley, this one. And also to the campaigning page there. So I'm going to hope to do in a couple of weeks' time a live program from Monkton Wild and have some of the people involved in doing these rural skills courses, and also some people talking about how easy it seems to be for ruthless people to do a hostile takeover of a charitable trust with multi-million pounds worth of assets. Actually, this is a very beautiful area with several acres of land, an old school built in the 1800s, which is one of the few really nice communities in the country. But another area that's been evicted, and this is a fascinating tale, is the town of Imber, and that was evacuated, they called it, but it really was evicted in 1943 during World War II. This is on Salisbury Plain, and at the time it was a village which was farmed, and there was something like 200 and 150 or 200 people living there, and the army came along and said, no, you're going to have to leave, it's okay, you can come back after the war, and of course they were never allowed to go back after the war, because the houses were already owned by the War Office or the War Department or whatever it was. And I managed to track down a chap called Stuart Wakefield this week, and he's done his dissertation all about the history of Imber, and there was another book I think called Little Imber on the Downs, and it's a place where, as a quid pro quo, the army, what they've done is they say a few days of the year people can go there, and one of those days is tomorrow and next weekend, where actually the roads are open that you can actually go to this village, which is right in the middle of Salisbury Plain, where the army do all their training. But anyway, I asked him about, in the longer interview you can get on thisweek.org.uk later tonight, I asked Stuart Wakefield about the post-war campaign by the residents of Imber to get their village back.
There was a very important campaign for the reinstatement of Imber. Gavin went to them actually in the very early 60s. And this was actually run by a chap from the Salisbury area. And what they were doing was what we would call today a mass trespass. And they accumulated, I forget the exact number, but I mean, don't quote me. So don't quote me. But I think something like about 2,000 or 3,000 people were going to go from the edge of Salisbury Plain down to the village of Imber. And what happened was they didn't on purpose ask for permission to do this. And of course the Ministry of Defence, sorry, the War Office, yeah, it was still the War Office. The War Office were told, well, actually, grant them retrospective permission to do this. Don't give them what we want or take them to court. You know, so it was an interesting way of handling this. And just a little sideline, the Minister of Defence at that time was this John Profumo, who you may well have heard of. John Profumo, and he was quite anti this group who was going to sort out the problem with Imber. But at the end of the day, I think the authority higher than him said, oi, you know, just calm down. And this thing will disappear. So it began to be a public inquiry, for want of a better expression, to see which way all this could go. Could they really claim the rights to get access to Imber? I mean, that's what they were trying to do, just to get access. You know, and then perhaps the momentum would grow from the people who used to live there. Say, actually, could we go back and live there in my old age? Perhaps something like that. But initially, they had the backing of the council, CPRE, Council for the Preservation of Rural England, the local county council, other departments. I can't think exactly who it was now. But there were other national bodies, if you like, who wanted to get involved at the beginning. But eventually, they got whittled away, and even the CPRE. Didn't turn up to give evidence. So it was actually carried against them. But the War Office was actually told to be a little bit more conciliatory and allow, if you like, access once or twice a year, hence these buses that are going there, which they still accept, to allow people to come and see what it was like.
Yeah, well, the book is by Rex Sawyer. It's called Little Imber on the Down, Salisbury Plains Ghost Village. And it is a little bit like that. Most of the pub is still there, although it's kind of, there's no beer anywhere left. There's an old manor house there. And the most interesting part of it is the church. St. Giles Church is still consecrated. They have Easter services and Christmas carol services, which is an amazing thing for the army to do. I think it's actually rather wonderful that in the middle of a place where they're training for war, that there's still a bit of room for a church and a church service. And there's all sorts of signs to the soldiers and tank drivers who are were training around there, just please, you know, avoid this church, you know, go round it or whatever, as they do actually with many of the ancient monuments. But anyway, the reason I'm talking about it is because tomorrow is Imber Bus Day, and that's another one of these websites. I think it's imberbus.co.uk or imberbusday.co.uk. You can find a very old style London Transport 1960s 1970s style timetable, which the boss of Network Rails had printed up, which has got several of the north west side of Salisbury Plains villages and towns, most principal of which is Warminster, which you can get to by train, all day bus service all day tomorrow, backwards and forwards and across Salisbury Plain, and with the grand prize, if you manage to get to Imber and manage to get up to the church there, St Giles Church, is also a cafe that you can sit and enjoy, and you can buy postcards of the old Imber and pictures of the old villages and things like that. It's absolutely wonderful. But of course, there is a land rights theme to this, and the idea that actually there was a just cause there. So I think the last person, as I say in the interview with Stuart Wakefield there, died last year and was buried in the church, someone who was actually born in Imber Village. And so this is just about fading out of human memory now. But the army do, as I say, allow people to go in and out. And so I will hopefully be bringing you some sort of little report, if I can get hold of anybody interesting who's there, for next week's show. Be
what the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow.
Never get to heaven.
So that's You Never Get to Heaven If You Break My Heart. That's from the year of 1973. And is it the Stylistics? No. Yeah, it's the Stylistics. And before that, we had What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. That's Jackie DeShannon, 1965. And before that, I think it was probably written quite a long time before that. That's Be Thou My Vision, the choir of Paisley Abbey. Now, I'm going to start a little, do a little quiz this week. It'd be interesting to see if anyone is able to guess the answer. And I would like you to, if you have got the answer, which is what I'm asking, is a very simple question. What's the connection between the last two songs there? And you can send in your answer to me at our address for not the BCFM Politics Show, which is 17 to 25. Jamaica Street, Bristol, BS2 8JP. That's 17 to 25 Jamaica Street, Bristol, BS2 8JP. On a postcard, please. And if you just write down the what it is that connects those last two songs, that's What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love by Jackie DeShannon, 1965, and You'll Never Get to Heaven If You Break My Heart by the Stylistics in 1973. And the first card we get here, we'll get, guess what, a free copy of my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which I suppose is in some ways is more important. But I tell you what, you know what I'll do. If you may have one of the books already, who knows? But if you would like either of the two books, just let me know on there. And if you can put a preference, either The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is my anthology of all of the. Extracts from various books which talk about secret government from the time of the English Civil War right the way through to now, and the assassination of Princess Diana by guess who? This guy who's supposed to be in charge now. Yeah, that's him. If you could send those, please, to me at not the BCFM Politics Show, 17 to 25, Jamaica Street, Bristol, BS2 8JP. It'd be interesting to see. So another thing about it, it's a good way of testing out the post, isn't it? To see if the post actually works or if it's sort of disappeared or whatever. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start this week, though, Martin. Is there anything particularly you want to talk about on the international scene before I get cracking with Palestine?
Well, we might as well go straight for Palestine.
Okay, because, I mean, there's some horrendous stuff going on that's not being reported here, it seems to me, at all. And particularly with the Israeli authorities. Now, we've now got this extreme right-wing government. I mean, is it fair to say, Martin, it's the most right-wing government that Israel has ever had? It's always had these right-wing governments, really, ever since the assassination of Rabin.
It is the most right-wing government they've ever had, yeah.
Why do you say that?
Well, because it just is. You know, I mean, people, you know, occasionally we sort of pontificate on this show about there's no difference between the left and the right, and that doesn't mean anything anymore. Well, I'm afraid it still does, and this is a very right-wing government. For example, they're just not interested in a two-state solution, which in a way is a liberation, because we say, right, so there's no peace talks, no possibility of any kind of peace, so we can impose sanctions on you, which, of course, is what needs to be done. They're totally dependent on US dollars to have their middle-class lifestyle, and they're very arrogant with it as well.
Well, one of the characteristics, it's interesting, isn't it?
We've been with their middle-class lifestyle.
We were talking earlier on about anti-Semitism. Well, what about the Israelis' utter racism against the Palestinians? We don't really hear very much about that, which is a great pity. You know, it's much more, it seems to me, much more important. And of course, the sorts of channels which do talk about it, like Press TV, we heard a little bit extract with Steve Keen on there earlier, are completely banned in Britain. So we've got this weird situation where it's almost as if some evil person somewhere, kind of, you know, Bond villain or something, has decided people in this part of the world are only going to be allowed to know this, and other people in this part of the world are only going to be able to know that. And so the Iranian Press TV channel seems to be one of the only channels, actually Al Jazeera is pretty good too, that covers stories like we're about to hear. This one was on Press TV, looking at this far-right racist Israeli government actually just blocking funds for many of the Palestinian councils around around their country because they're Palestinians and because the Israeli government are racist, just stopping money going for them to actually organise their democratic affairs.
On this segment of the program, Israel takes yet another step to add to the sufferings of Palestinians. The regime has frozen the funds of Palestinian councils in East Al-Quds. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has announced the freeze of millions of dollars meant for local councils and educational programs, citing crime and safety fears. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also backed the decision. However, several Israeli officials have strongly criticized the plan, saying that it will promote hatred and racism. The five-year funds plan approved in 2018 was the regime's acknowledgement of years-long social and economic inequality against Palestinians. Israel's oppression of Palestinians has intensified, especially under the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu, who assumed office last December. The regime has resorted to any form of brutal measure, including daily raids, detention, and killing of Palestinians to constrain their activities. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University, Ali Salam, joining us. He is the editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
First, I would like to highlight that the path of resistance is the only path to resolve this problem. I would like to acknowledge that today is the one-year anniversary of the martyrdom of Martyr Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, may Allah be pleased with him, who really woke up the Palestinian people to this farce between that no matter what political leanings the so-called Zionist government has, that they are always there to stamp out the existence of the Palestinians, and the only solution is to rise up and resist. So these types of aids and funds towards various Palestinian councils is a means of buying influence. It's not a means of caring about the Palestinians or that they recognize the problems of the Palestinians. They view the Palestinians as subhuman and inferior, no matter whether they're so-called left or so-called right on the Israeli political spectrum. The Palestinian Authority itself is a tool and collaborates with the Israeli government to crack down on the armed resistance groups who have a legal, moral, and divine right to defend their homeland, to reestablish their national identity, and to liberate their land from the Israeli occupation, from the river to the sea, not just the so-called two-state solution that the various deceptive agents of Zionism would like to see happen. So these aids are meant to essentially buy influence in the community. For example, last year, or maybe it was this year, I read that they have a piece of legislation in the Knesset which seeks to change the curriculum of education. So these funds that would have gone to education would have come with strings attached, which means to defang their programs so that the mentality of resistance and the mentality of seeing the Zionist entity as temporary and illegitimate would have been gutted, so that people become more ingratiated in this idea of so-called coexistence. Coexisting, for example, with the thief that comes into your home, in your own home, allowing him to have part of your room as long as you play along and play nice. You know, this kind of fake tolerance, this fake anti-racism. I thought, honestly, when I read this news reports from Reuters and Haaretz, I was laughing out loud that Yair Lapid, one of the biggest war criminals and butchers of the Zionist regime, had the audacity to call Netanyahu racist. These people who bomb Palestinians and Arabs in Palestine and Lebanon and Syria just for the sake that they're subhuman and they want to take their land and they just want to completely destroy everything that's in the way of establishing their very satanic and racial supremacist regime. This guy has the audacity to virtue signal and say that Netanyahu is anti-racist. So it's not just the right-wing regime, it's not just Netanyahu, sure. It's the whole entire Zionist occupation, and additionally their collaborationists within the traitorous and deceptive Palestinian Authority. I believe that the spirit of Ibrahim al-Nabulsi should get rid of both of the Palestinian Authority and the Zionist regime and establish a fully sovereign Palestinian state from the river to the sea.
So, yes, that's a Press TV report there. I didn't catch the name of the... He seemed to say talk about two speakers, but we only heard from one there at the beginning. Martin, this is pretty serious, isn't it? This is a programme which was promised by a previous government, not quite so extreme right-wing racist, back in 2018 to, sort of, very, very basic health and educational programmes for the Palestinian parts of Israel, now just accounts just being blocked by this extreme right organization. The idea seems to be to antagonize and anger Palestinians so they pick up the gun.
Well, that is the strategy, yes. I mean, these, I presume that what we're talking about here is Palestinian residents of Israel who are in fact Israeli citizens, but they're second class citizens. And the right wing in Israel are now definitely saying that this is a state for Jews from all over the world. Anybody can come as long as they're a Jew, but it's not really a state for Palestinians at all. And they are hoping that by provoking the Palestinians and getting an uprising going, and then maybe as part of a general Middle East war, they'll be able to ethnically cleanse Palestine completely. That is their mad goal. And, of course, they were bombing in Damascus, Israeli Air Force bombing in Damascus this week. The problem that they have got is that, in actual fact, they haven't got the military strength they think they have. It's being eroded. In the 2006 war in Lebanon, they lost. A lot of their tanks were knocked out by Hezbollah's anti-tank weaponry. And Hezbollah now have masses and masses of quite accurate rockets. So if they go to war with the rest of the Middle East, most of the time, Israelis live in gated communities where they can do exactly what they want and they don't have to worry about anything. But if they decide to go to war with the rest of the Middle East, they're going to die in those gated communities. And that may change their mind. We'll see. Dead people don't get to vote, do they?
So 30 council heads from Palestinian communities in Israel staged a demonstration in front of the Israeli Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem last Sunday, protesting the far-right finance minister Bezalel Smotrich's decision to withhold the transfer of 300 million Israeli shekels, that's around about $80 million, allocated to the Palestinian municipalities. The protesters called for Prime Minister Netanyahu to intervene directly on the matter and transfer the money to the authorities immediately. The withheld money includes tens of millions of shekels, which were earmarked for addressing the lack of classrooms in Palestinian schools in Israel. This is the sort of thing that was going on in apartheid South Africa, just purely race fueled. But you said these mad policies by the far right in Israel. But actually, they are more evil, surely. They have evil intentions. And the idea here is to just drive these people out of the land because they hate them. Now, it's easy to call them mad, but there is a sort of method in their madness. The idea is to drive these people potty and just force them to leave.
Well, yes, I still think it's mad, because ultimately, if you bet the farm, you can lose the farm. Don't forget, the French settlers in Algeria have been living in Algeria for 120 years, when, after the end of the Second World War, the Algerians rose up against them. They didn't try and compromise. They demanded that they were going to carry on running the place. It was their place, didn't belong to the locals, weren't going to accept them. Very similar to what we've seen with the Israelis in Palestine. But they've only been there decades. But virtually every single Algerian settler had to leave Algeria when the French army withdrew. And ultimately, if the Israelis are not prepared to negotiate with the Palestinians for some kind of shared existence, then the existence of the state of Israel.
Yeah, but look, I mean, surely the point here, and it's worked, it seems, ever since the 1990s and the Rabin assassination, it's worked. This is a political strategy. The idea is hate, hate, hate on the Palestinians, and let's just create this racist war here and this horrific apartheid, and we can consider the Palestinians to be a terrible threat. What we'll do is we'll just lie about that, and we'll garner votes as a result.
Yes. But as I say, if you bet the farm, you can lose the farm. Now, if they go to war with Iran, they will lose. if they go to war with Lebanon, they will lose. The Palestinians are obviously extremely exposed where they are, but in a World War III situation, states come into existence and states go out of existence. Israel was created on the back of World War II, and it could disappear in World War III. And you could have a situation where all of the people in Israel of Jewish extraction will have to go. It's up to them.
It certainly
They've got
could.
To decide whether they want to bet the farm
is,
or not.
I mean, it's always important to look at some of the positives going on over there. It's not easy to find them sometimes, but the Palestinians have welcomed this week China's new Middle East role, but it's not the mediation they needed. It is feasible for China to continue playing an important role in mediating Middle East conflicts. In fact, it already has in the case of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. However, mediation is hardly the issue. Even before Beijing successfully managed to achieve reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Iran last April, Chinese diplomacy has shown exceptional maturity. For many years, the Chinese have been perceived to be an outsider in global affairs, supposedly contending themselves to economic expansion or regional economic integration. Former US President Donald Trump forced, or rather accelerated, China's global outreach when, in 2018, he launched an unprecedented trade war on the powerful Asian country. Trump's plan backfired. Not only did Washington fail to dissuade Beijing from bowing to American diktats, it also inspired what became known as China's wolf diplomacy, a self-assertive Chinese approach to foreign policy. From an American or Western viewpoint, the new tactic was perceived to be hostile and aggressive. But from a Chinese perspective, the new policy was necessitated by a relentless war launched against China by successive US administrations. Anyway, the point of this article from antiwar.com, Martin, is saying, well, actually, the Chinese have now become a major international diplomatic broker because of the inability of people to actually negotiate and trust the Americans anymore.
Well, that's right. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, this BRICS meeting coming up in Johannesburg is going to go down in history, probably. The Chinese are coming out of their corner fighting, as well they might. The success of the Russian military operation in the Ukraine has led many people in the world to conclude that the Americans are a busted flush. And they try and, you know, they had to withdraw from Afghanistan, for example. So all the British boys who died in Afghanistan, all for nothing. Why did we go there?
Well, I think we went there for a particular reason, which was to threaten and surround the Russians. I think that's what we went there for, isn't it?
Well, and also to mess up the Chinese.
And with the Chinese, yeah. But then, of course, when the plans were launched for the provocation to get the Russians to go into Ukraine, they realised, well, actually, our troops might be a little bit isolated over there.
Well, I think what the fact is, they thought that they would be able to crash the Russian economy. And it turns out they haven't crashed the Russian economy, they've crashed the European economy. And that ultimately is potentially revolutionary.
Okay, well, let's look at Ukraine. We do as we do pretty much every week. And when I spoke to Nick Corbishley earlier this week, he's living in Spain. And he had some very interesting things to say about the Spanish press. Martin, apparently, a lot of the senior Spanish people, including some guy who's on the steering committee of Bilderberg, they're putting out messages saying, actually, this whole Ukraine business, we're just going to have to pull away right now. What do you make of that? Before we hear Nick's take on it, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's very difficult in NATO countries at the moment to tell the truth about what's happened in the Ukraine. I mean, you're just shouted down with a wall of, it's gradually, you know, the fever is passing. You know, you don't see people wandering around waving Ukrainian flags like you did a year ago, because it's beginning to dawn.
Yeah, well, this is what's going on at the very top.
Or nothing.
This is what's going on at the very top level in Spain, according to Nick.
This came out of the blue. So, I mean, we've had, much like in the UK, we've had a year and a half of more or less one message about the Ukraine war, which is Ukraine was invaded completely unjustly by Russia. Russia had no justification for taking such an action, and it has been a terrible victim of that invasion since then. And every single possible means must be taken to defend Ukraine against Russia. And that includes the sanctions you mentioned, which have done enormous damage to the European Union's economy and the UK's economy, and I would argue also the global economy, by fueling this huge surge in inflation. Though I would say, I mean, it has to be noted that inflation was already beginning to take off before the Ukraine war. Lots and lots of politicians in the West tried to use the Ukraine war as the only cause of inflation. But I mean, I remember writing about inflation in 2021 as it began creeping up, and in many countries it was already well above kind of the target level for the central bank well before the war. So that has to be said. But yeah, I mean, basically, Spain has been following towing the NATO line for the last year and a half very faithfully, and that has been very much reflected in the media, but that I would say changed significantly this week when José Luis Cebrán wrote an article in El País that essentially started arguing that maybe this was a bad idea. He started saying that, he said in his article that this war in Ukraine is not just a war about an invader and a poor, defenseless country that is trying to defend itself. He actually came out and said this is a proxy war. And he began saying that, yes, this is not in the interest long term of the European Union and is actually potentially a threat to the long term survival of the European Union as it kind of becomes its own interest becomes supplanted by the objectives of the NATO military alliance. Those are his exact words. It's interesting, the title of this article, In Defense of Ukraine to the Death of the Ukrainians. So it's quite a vivid image that, you know, you could imagine some other article, maybe in Russia, writing, or some other somewhere, in, let's say India, or a country that is not a NATO member, coming out of an important publication. I mean, El País is kind of like the Guardian of Spain. It is a very, very important publication. It's the New York Times of Spain. And José Luis Cebrán is the founder of this newspaper. He was the person who was the president of the holding company until, I think, 2018. He is also, interestingly, the only Spanish member, permanent member of the Bilderberg Group. So this is a man, this is not just some journalist, this is, arguably, he's consistently in the list of the top 40, 50 most influential Spanish people. This is, I think, a very important step within Spain. I believe what they're trying to do is to soften up public opinion towards the idea of essentially abandoning the Ukraine cause, which, as we've seen with the pandemic and the vaccines and the vaccine passports, it's, before governments take a very, very big U-turn on overarching policy that has affected all of our lives, they have to soften up public opinion. They have to start shifting the way people think towards the subject at hand, subtly, little by little, before actually taking that action.
Nick Corbishley speaking to me earlier this week. You can find him on Twitter and elsewhere. Just to correct the Bilderberg references there that he made, he is not currently a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee Steering Committee. He's a former member. One of the things it does say about him is that he's the only Hispanic academic member of the Bilderberg Club and journalist, and the only Spanish-speaking member who has had executive functions at Bilderberg, which I'm not totally sure about. I'm sure there might be one or two other Spanish people, such as on the actual Bilderberg. I'll just look that up, Martin, because I think that the current Spanish representative is not him on the steering committee. But the point is, you know, that this is quite an important move. The Bilderberg sometimes do this, like we had Carrington during the time of the Yugoslav crisis, saying, "Oh, you know, we've got to be very careful here. This is a, you know, this may be the wrong kind of war." Kissinger saying the same sort of thing about Ukraine. But so, what do you make of the El País in Spain really coming out quite vehemently now, editorially anyway, saying, well, this whole Ukraine war thing, you know, maybe we should just drop it?
Well, I think there are various straws in the wind, because basically the Ukrainians have been defeated on the battlefield, and you can carry on cheering them on, but it's not going to make any difference. The problem is that the population in the West have been brainwashed to believe, A, that the Ukrainian cause is just, which it isn't. The Russian-speaking population in the East have voted to leave the Ukraine. They don't see themselves as Ukrainians. They never did. So, in other words, who's invading who at the moment? The Russian army is defending...
This is starting to sound very Orwellian, Martin. This is starting to sound very Orwellian. It's like we're supposed to forget the enemy that we had yesterday. We've got a new and different enemy today.
Well, I think what's happening is that they're in... I mean, obviously, I read a lot about this. They're having all sorts of anguished discussions behind the scenes about how they can extract themselves from the mess that they've got themselves into. Because if it goes on, they're going. You know, NATO may collapse, the EU may collapse. You know, all of these things may happen, and because they bet the farm. I'm talking about the Israelis betting the farm. They've bet the farm. And it's very difficult for them to back down. And, of course, the other reason it makes it difficult to back down is the things they're talking about. Well, maybe we could just freeze the conflict and, you know, get the Russians to agree to a ceasefire. But since they've openly boasted that when we talk to the Russians, we're actually lying, and we never, you know, we actually want regime change in Russia, and we're not making any bones about it, then there's no incentive for the Russian side to give them a ceasefire. We offered you a ceasefire at the beginning. You said you didn't want one. Now you can't have one because we're winning and we're not going to give you one.
Well, Juan Luis Cebrian, who is the founder of El País, is around about 80 years old. So maybe that he's just thinking, well, I'm going to die soon, so I can say what I want now. I don't have to do Bilderbergers tell me. But the other thing is, he is a former member of the steering committee of Bilderberg. But now the actual Spanish steering committee member on the Bilderberg is a woman called Ana Botín, who's the group executive chair of the Banco Santander. And of course, you know, over the years, the Bilderberg has gone from the whole sort of cultural sector, trade unionists and leaders of the Labour Party, which was Hugh Gaitskell, for example, was on the steering committee of Bilderberg at the start, over increasingly to, well, another one that just pops out at me here is Mark Carney, who was the boss of regulation at the Bank for International Settlements, that whose lack of regulation caused the 2008 financial crisis. You know, so they're mostly bankers there now. Anyway, Martin, finally, what do you think? Do you think that the tide is starting to turn now in the NATO countries against this? That the NATO I mean, there didn't seem to be many people who were going to be able to carry on in Stoltenberg's role, and it seems that he's the only one left who'll do what he's doing.
Well, another senior NATO official whose name escapes me, not Stoltenberg, he said this week, well, maybe the Ukrainians are going to have to cede territory in order to get, and then we can bring them into NATO. Now, of course, Zelensky and the Ukrainians went nuts, and he was forced to walk that back. But in any case, even if they are having second thoughts and thinking, well, we need to sort of settle this somehow. And, of course, there will be people, you know, there'll be hawks and doves, as they usually are.
Well, let's just reference that, because it's a NATO official called Stian Jensen, who sounds a little bit Nordic or Scandinavian to me, on Wednesday this week, said that comments that he made the previous day regarding Ukraine ceding land in order to gain membership of NATO were a mistake. But anyway, the point is that there is this kind of dilemma, which I don't hear anyone else talking about, Martin, at the heart of this Ukraine conflict, in that as soon as there's a peace deal, that means that Ukrainians are going to join NATO and can join NATO and will join NATO, and therefore the Russians don't really want that.
No, you see, this, the, NATO is now thinking in terms of, can't we go back to the Minsk agreements? But of course, the Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 on the understanding that the Ukrainians and NATO would fulfil their part of the bargain. Now, not only did they not fulfil their part of the bargain, but because of what Merkel and Hollande said, they went to Minsk determined to deceive the Russians, and they've boasted about the fact that we deceived them so that they could build up their forces so that they could retake the Donbass from the rebels. And so when the Russians intervened, that's where that why do you think that the Ukrainian army wasn't surrounding Kiev? It was all because it was all down in the Donbass preparing to attack the breakaway republic.
That's right, exactly.
And,
yeah.
And that's exactly the moment where at that point the Russians said, we're going to intervene.
Yes. You're just particularly Martin, with the Munich Security Conference and Zelensky demanding nuclear weapons, I don't think the Russians really had a lot of choice in that. Anyway, we're going to move on now to Tucker Carlson is down, but most definitely not out. If you follow him on his various platforms, I think he's doing quite a lot of these live things on Twitter. And anyway, he's still around, even though he's been sacked by Fox News over that, what I think was almost certainly a confidentiality agreement that had been signed as part of the Dominion voting machine court case against Fox News. So, you know, as part of that, Tucker Carlson has to be elbowed out and isn't allowed to say why because of the non-disclosure agreements as part of the his contract or whatever with Fox, I would imagine. But he may talk about it one day, who knows, when he feels a bit more plucky about exactly what the shenanigans were behind that. But anyway, he has been chatting with all sorts of interesting people, so it's a really good idea. You can find him online. And this week he had a conversation with Robert Kennedy, who's standing for the Democratic nomination to be president. And they talk about various things, but for me the most interesting was when he started to press Robert Kennedy on his uncle JFK's assassination back in the 1960s.
You've said a number of times publicly, many times publicly, and I think it's now been confirmed that CIA had knowledge of, at best, had knowledge of your uncle's assassination, new things that's still being hidden now. What do you think, and that's obviously true, what do you think the motive was in that killing?
Well, I think the people who were involved in it, the specific people who were involved in it were almost all associated with the Miami station, which was the largest CIA station at that time, and was basically it was the Cuban station. And the people who were involved in that station were people like Bill Harvey and David Attlee Phillips, who was clearly involved in my uncle's assassination. He was, by all evidence, he was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler at the CIA, and then E. Howard Hunt, who made a confession, David Morales, who is the, you know, the chief hitman. He ran the Operation Phoenix program in Vietnam. He killed 10,000 people, civilians over there, murdered them, and he also gave a confession of being in Dallas. And then there were most of the people were associated with Cuba, and the, you know, and the impetus came from that group of people who were angry at my uncle for not sending in air cover during the Bay of Pigs invasion, and then even more so after the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. My uncle then developed this friendship with Khrushchev, and he shut down all of the Cuban attacks by Alpha 66 and these other groups that were harassing Cuba. They were sinking ships, sinking Russian ships. They were operating flotillas out of South Florida and doing raids on. And my uncle and father sent the Coast Guard down to confiscate their boats and their weaponry and to arrest the ones that continued to do it. And those people, those individuals, were also, you know, have been traced and tracked the assassination you know, over the years. And they're now there's been, you know, there's millions of documents. I mean,
But why not release all the documents? What doesn't make sense to me is why not just admit it now? I mean, no one you describe would be still alive.
There's no living everybody person. Everybody now, all virtually.
So why wouldn't Biden declassify these documents?
I don't know why. And why would Trump not?
I agree. I know why Trump wouldn't, because he was convinced by Mike Pompeo not to. So, and it's not an excuse, but not, you know.
Yeah, but we don't know what Mike Pompeo said to him.
No, but that's the point. Like, yeah. What could possibly be the law
requires them to do it. So the JFK assassination's law required that all documents be released by 2017.
Yeah,
and yet they refused. So they.
But it suggests that there's something big.
4,000 of them. That are left, and you have to assume. And again, I try not to talk about things that I cannot document.
Right.
But I think it's a fair assumption that they're not protecting individuals, that they're protecting some institutional interest.
Most powerful institution in America?
Well, I don't know.
You don't know?
Yeah, I don't know.
But there must be something, because why wouldn't they just release it?
And by the way, for people, you know, you and I having this conversation about who did the assassination, why they did it, a lot of that is the stuff that I've told you, and I've tried to stick to things that, you know, that are documentable, and the names, et cetera. But for people who want a real, you know, kind of a panoramic view of what happened, I think the best book that's been written about this is Jim Douglas's book, which is called The Unspeakable, because he's done something that, you know, after the Warren Commission, that became the orthodoxy. And the New York Times and all the major news organizations have enforced that orthodoxy, and anybody who challenges that orthodoxy becomes a conspiracy theorist. And in fact, in 1967, the CIA sent a letter out to a telecom out to all of its Operation Mockingbird people, which are all the assets it had in the American press, more than 400 people, editors, senior writers in the American press, saying, from now on, anybody who questions the single gunman theory of the Kennedy assassination should be characterized as a conspiracy theorist. And they didn't coin the word conspiracy theory, but they popularized it with that memo. They sent a memo out to all their stations saying that talk should be discouraged. So but what happened after that is then in 1979, the House Assassinations Committee met for a year and a half, and they looked at much more evidence than the Warren Commission did, including, you know, Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles had run the Warren Commission. He was the head of the CIA who my uncle fired. When my uncle died, he said, I'm glad the little shit is dead. He thought he was a god. That's what he said to a young reporter. And then he becomes head of the commission that is, you know, it shouldn't have been called the Warren Commission. It should be called the Dulles, because Earl Warren had a full-time job at the Supreme Court. All the other guys on the Warren Commission had full-time jobs as senator and congressman. The only guy who went to every meeting and, you know, looked at every piece of evidence and developed the questions for the witnesses was Alan Dulles. He was running the entire Warren Commission. And he should have been the prime suspect in the crime. And he was communicating secretly with the people at the CIA, with David Atlee Phillips, with George Johannides, who was the CIA liaison, telling them what, you know, what questions were going to be asked and what they should reveal, and with J. Edgar Hoover at the same time. Well, the whole thing was a coordinated kind of kabuki theater. But then Congress goes back and investigates it in 79. And Congress then comes back after a year and a half seeing a lot more stuff and says, and they conclude this was a conspiracy.
Yes.
So they make that official, you know, so anybody who says it was just Lee Harvey Oswald is differing from the people who actually made the investigation.
So given
most of the people on that staff who I've talked to believed that it was the CIA. And as you know, at that time, the dispute between them was it the mob and the CIA, because there was a lot of mob involvement. Johnny Roselli, Sam Giancana, who was the Chicago boss, Santos Traficante was the Tampa boss, and Carlos Marcello, who was the New Orleans boss, were all involved. And they all had casinos in Havana, and they were working with the CIA to assassinate Castro. So they had hitmen at their disposal, and they were training Cubans who were sharpshooters for Batista as hitmen. And I've talked to some of the hitmen. I've talked to Antonio Vecchiana, who was involved, and who was also David Atlee Phillips' handler. David Atlee Phillips was his handler, and he was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler. So Vecchiana met Oswald in Dallas in September of 1963. Oh, I've talked to, the people who were actually working for the CIA and the mob at that time, to kill Castro, and how they were then pivoted to this, some of them were pivoted to this new project.
Well, absolutely fascinating. I find the whole JFK thing very annoying, really, because the actual truth is out there. It's very much the X-Files style thing. We've been playing bits and extracts from a long interview, a couple of different long interviews with James Files, who went down to Dallas to kill Kennedy, along with Johnny Roselli and Charles Nicoletti, who we mentioned there, with David Atlee Phillips as their controller, also of Lee Harvey Oswald too, from the Central Intelligence Agency. It's good to hear him filling in some little gaps there as well, particularly the confession of E. Howard Hunt. I mean, he was also a CIA guy, and these were all the people who were really bitter after after Kennedy pulled the air support, as he said there. And I think I'll probably put a link up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, to the last confession of E. Howard Hunt, the ultimate keeper of secrets regarding who killed JFK. Once, when the old spy master thought he was dying, his eldest son came to visit him at his home in Miami. The scourges recently had been constant and terrible: lupus, pneumonia, cancers of the jaw and prostate, gangrene, and amputation of his left leg was like something was eating him up. Long past were his years of heroic service for his country. In the CIA, he'd helped mastermind the violent removal of duly elected leftist president in Guatemala and assisted in subterfuges that led to the murder of Che Guevara. But no longer could you see in him the suave, pipe-smoking, cocktail-party-loving clandestine operative whose Cold War exploits he himself had almost obsessively turned into novels, one of which, The East of Farewell, the New York Times once called the best sea story of World War II. Anyway, it goes on, this article, to explain that he did actually give a confession to being centrally involved in, E. Howard Hunt did, in the Kennedy assassination. So, and also, of course, there, Martin, we had the mention of Alan Dulles, being really interesting to hear him say that it shouldn't have been called the Warren Commission. It should have been called the Dulles Commission. And of course, Dulles was the guy, who not only had he just sacked, but if you go back to our reports that we've been doing over the years on Op JB and the extraction of Martin Bormann and all the Nazi cash at the end of the Second World War, and the activities of Bormann over in South America creating these 750 companies, the billions of the Nazi loot from World War II were actually laundered through the Dulles brothers law firm in New York, Sullivan and Cromwell. So this guy Dulles, who was heading the CIA and who John F. Kennedy sacked, was actually one of the major criminals of World War II. And so it's hardly surprising to hear his activities behind the scenes in the Warren Commission.
Well, it's not surprising, is it? I mean, the dogs in the street know what happened here in its essentials, don't we? We all know what happened, but there's a huge cognitive dissonance, isn't there? Cognitive dissonance. You've talked about this. I mean, it's great that Robert Kennedy's prepared to come out and say these things, and hopefully that will get some traction. But the reason we're in the mess we're in is because the people who did that got away with it, and they were never punished, and they've carried on doing stuff like it
ever since.
Anyway, so you'll be pleased to hear we're going to skip over the Nazi roots of the Brussels EU, the interview with Dr. Messias Ruth, the German, which was recommended last week by Jungle Bus Millie. We'll do that next week. But we're going to finish with a bit of a sort of slightly comedy item, if it wasn't that he took himself so seriously, and that is David Icke, because he had an appearance on Talk Radio this week on the Eamon Holmes programme. And so let's have a little listen to an extract from that now, where Icke talks about his theories and particularly about China.
You said something there in the trailer about a chair, which was, what did you say? Was it really there? Had it really got mass?
Well, it's not there. Quantum physics has shown it's not there in the form that we experience it.
Which is?
We experience it. Well, this is a long story.
Oh, right, okay.
And this movie, Renegade, explains it. And, of course, we've got graphics and stuff like that. So yes. It's explained very simply. But
right,
this world is not what we think it is.
What I love about you is that you get the brain cells moving, because no matter what the subject, I can pick any subject out, and you will have a theory, and you'll make me think, and you will provoke me into thinking, is he right, or is he wrong, or can I see sense in that? And there's so many things. And I want to, first of all, talk to you about, in the news today, we've got all this idea that this Chinese communications company, Huawei, are investing in the UK 5G network. America doesn't want them, Canada doesn't want them, New Zealand doesn't want them, Australia doesn't want them, whatever. Yet we have taken them on board amid criticism that it may be just a hotline to the Chinese regime. What's your view?
Well, in many ways it's a smokescreen from the real point, and the real point is 5G and what it does to the human body and what it does to the human mind. See, going back to the other question, everything in this reality, including the human body, is actually an energetic field of information. And if you think of a computer that's decoding Wi-Fi, if the computer is malfunctioning, if it's skewed in some way, then what appears on the screen is skewed. And we are interacting with these energetic fields. We are these energetic fields, which quantum physics now has well shown exist. And the brain works electrically. It processes information electrically. It communicates with the cells and the cellular structure electrically. And it works on particular frequencies. And therefore, any external technological frequency that disturbs the frequency balance of the body and the frequency balance of the brain is going to have, depending on how extreme it does it, it's going to have anything from mild to catastrophic effects on human health and on the human psychology. And this is why you've got independent scientists, not the ones that are representing the telecommunications industry, but independent scientists who've actually written to people like the World Health Organization and the UN saying, we've got to stop rolling this out until we know the effect this is going to have.
So you're more concerned about that effect than the idea that the Chinese regime would be listening in or be able to paralyze our whole communications network within this country?
Well, this is the whole point, is that the communications industry and the surveillance industry, whether it's Chinese technology or whether it's American technology or whatever technology it is, they're all doing it. This is a global movement of controlling what we think, what we see, and keeping us under constant surveillance. I mean, the level of surveillance now is unbelievable. Just you know, we talked last time I was on, when people are having a conversation at home about
television,
say a product.
Yeah.
Next thing they know, that product is on
their phone.
Their phone, on their Facebook feed. The level of surveillance already is fantastic. And it's coming out of Silicon Valley, and it's coming out of China, and wherever it's coming from. So to focus on one area, China, is actually okay. a diversion. It's what's happening globally, of which China will be part, but Silicon Valley is massively a part.
So, yeah, he sort of ends up talking a bit of sense there, Martin, but, I mean, he's not being very kind to the Chinese, really. He's saying that it's all a kind of big global conspiracy. I suppose, in a way, I kind of agree that these that there are some aspects of this technology which, you know, whatever the empire is that's using it, it's a bad technology and we should be fighting against it, really.
Well, I think the problem with this is that because there is such a conflictual relationship between the Chinese and the West, that both camps are developing 5G as part of military preparations. You can be quite sure that 5G or similar things are being used extensively in the war in the Ukraine. Electronic warfare is what it's all about. And when you're fighting a war, you don't worry too much about this may be bad for human health. It's winning the war that takes the priority.
And what about David Icke's philosophical point there, that actually the chair is not there?
Well, that's a philosophical point, but it's not really that important in the big scheme. You know, we could argue about that. That's not really politics, is it? It's about, you know, the existence or non-existence of the chair.
I mean, no, but I mean, for example, in the clip, the final clip I'm about to play now, this is one of the funniest things I've ever heard him go on about. He's going on about the moon, but he certainly is implying that the moon is actually there. I mean, you know, he's saying the chair is not there, but the moon is. I don't quite understand that. I mean,
let's put it this way. David Icke is not a scientist, okay? He's got his views, but he's not a scientist.
I don't know if people realise, but one of the things maybe I've said this before, but one of the things that David Icke does, that if he gets an email and someone speaks to him about a subject, the same kind of subject in the same day, that he believes that that's some kind of special message for him and it must be true. Now, obviously, there are potential massive flaws in that argument, because someone could be just conning him by walking into his office and talking to him about something and having sent an email earlier that day from pretending to be somebody else, you know. So I don't think you know he's able to really be rigorous about what he's saying, and that's to be proved. We can say goodbye to you now, Martin. You can disappear off and have your supper if you're a good lad, and we'll see you next week. But we'll finish with a clip this now from David Icke reviewing this in one of his speeches a couple of years ago, this book Who Built the Moon.
And the truth is, and honest scientists will tell you, they have no clue where the moon come from, and it shouldn't, by physics, be there. This guy, Isaac Asimov, a Russian professor of biochemistry, did a lot of writing on this sort of stuff, and he said this, quite rightly, "We cannot help but come to the conclusion that the moon by rights ought not to be there. The fact that it is one of those strokes of luck almost too good to accept. Small planets such as Earth with weak gravitational fields might well lack satellites. In general, then, when a planet does have satellites, those satellites are much smaller than the planet itself. Some scientists don't even talk about a planet-satellite relationship, but a planet-planet relationship. The moon's bigger than Pluto. The best explanation for the moon is observational error. The moon doesn't exist, that scientist said. Another one from NASA. It seems easier to explain the non-existence of the moon than its existence. And then we get the hollow moon. This is what I'm saying, and others have said, is that it's a hollowed out planetoid. In November 1969, the moon was hit by a lunar module to the equivalent of 1 ton of TNT. The shock waves built up, and NASA scientists said the moon rang like a bell. Morris Ewing, a co-director of the seismic experiment, told the news conference, "As for the meaning of it, I'd rather not make an interpretation right now, but it is as though someone had struck a bell, say in the belfry of a church, a single blow, and found that the reverberation from it continued for 30 minutes. A guy called Gordon MacDonald said in the early 1960s, "It would seem that the moon is more like a hollow than a homogeneous sphere." And this guy from MIT said the lunar orbiter experiments had vastly improved knowledge of the moon's gravitational field and indicated the frightening possibility that the moon might be hollow. A launch vehicle struck the moon with the equivalent of 11 tons of TNT. A NASA scientist said the moon reacted like a gong and continued to vibrate for 3 hours and 20 minutes to a depth of up to 25 miles. Ken Johnson, a supervisor of the Data and Photo Control Department during the Apollo missions, told Who Built the Moon author Alan Butler that the moon not only rang like a bell, but the whole moon wobbled in such a precise way that it was almost as though it had gigantic hydraulic damper struts inside it. These two Russian scientists from the Soviet Academy of Sciences wrote an article in 1970 in Sputnik magazine in Russia headed, Is the Moon the Creation of an Alien Intelligence? And all these years later, it indicates to the fact that they were right. What they point out, and others point out, is the outer surface of the moon is extremely hard and contains minerals like titanium. Moon rocks have been found to contain processed metals, including brass and mica, and the elements uranium-236 and neptunium-237 that have never been found to occur naturally. It is more likely that what we have here is a very ancient spaceship, the interior of which was filled with fuel for the engines and materials and appliances for repair work, navigation instruments, observation equipment, and all manner of machinery. In other words, everything necessary to enable this caravel of the universe to serve as a Noah's Ark, appropriate, of intelligence, perhaps even as the home of a whole civilization, envisaging a prolonged thousands of millions of years existence and long wanderings through space, thousands of millions of miles.
That's David Icke there explaining that the moon is actually a hollow metal spaceship. Or, you know, he really is. The thing is, he's not just quoting this stuff. He's going in behind it, which I just find, you know, quite disturbing, really. He's saying, well, yes, this guy, Isaac Asimov, not Isaac Asimov, but a Russian guy, you know, has come out with all these various theories. Anyway, there's a certain absurdity, and I think, you know, it always tickles me to listen to that Mr. Icke's. So what is David Icke? Let's just finish on that. What is David Icke? He's what's called a nutter magnet. The intelligence services would refer to him as a nutter magnet. The idea is that they can feed him stuff. They know he'll come out and believe it. For example, he came out with this thing right at the very start in the London Real interview saying COVID-19 does not exist. You know, it doesn't exist. And this has now been actually taken up by all sorts of other people. There's been films done about it. But the idea is that this is taken up by those that follow Icke. So if you have a look at the history of MI5, and Victor Rothschild was in charge during many ways during the Second World War and after the Second World War of MI5, what they were doing in World War II was something called the Double Cross. Now, this was German agents who'd been turned and were fed information by the British authorities, most of which was true in one way or another, may have been exaggerated. Obviously, a lot of exaggeration goes on in the intelligence and journalism worlds. And when it came to the really crucial things like D-Day, they would be fed totally false information. So this would completely throw the collectors at the other end, who thought they had a good bunch of agents, but actually they weren't. They were just feeding them nonsense. And a nutter magnet operates in exactly the same fashion. So Icke will be being fed some decent material, some of it quite good. And then at crucial times, like when it comes to 9/11 and the no planes theory, or COVID and this whole idea that there's no such thing as a virus and that COVID-19 didn't exist, just as the authorities might be catching up with people like Peter Daszak and Eco Health Alliance, spreading COVID to the world via the Wuhan lab, these theories then come out there. So, yeah, MI5 nutter magnet. That's David Icke in my book. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download the MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. You can follow Tony Gosling Censored, that's me, on Telegram. Do please read, send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. And don't forget, if you know the connection between the last two songs we played during the break, do please send a postcard to 17 to 25 Jamaica Street, Bristol, BS2 8JP, which is up there on the website too, if you forget it, to me, Tony Gosling, at the Not the BCFM Politics Show at that address. And it's a good way of testing out the posts, and also you may even get yourself, if you're the first one to arrive, a book in the post from me, either The Traitors of Arnhem or The Siege of Heaven Reader. Please let me know which one you prefer when you send in your answer to the question. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join Not the BCFM Politics Show, talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Stand down, Margaret. Stand down, Margaret, stand down, please stand down, Margaret. I say stand down, Margaret, stand down, please stand down, Margaret.